Hey, Project Big Screen listeners, you can find us every Monday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
If your hair isn't performing like it used to, the answer isn't another hat. It's a proactive approach. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement brand. It's also NSF certified for sport and the official hair growth partner of Major League Baseball, the only hair growth supplement trusted by the pros. Visit Nutrafol.com, enter promo code PMT. Get $10 off your first month subscription, and you get free shipping. That's NUTRAFOL.com, promo code PMT.
Work hard and hydrate hard with Body Armor Flash IV. Whether you're working in extreme heat or powering through a long shift, Body Armor Flash IV delivers faster, longer-lasting hydration. With more than 2,000 milligrams of electrolytes, vitamins B and C, and zinc, coconut water, and no artificial sweeteners, flavors, or dyes, Body Armor Flash IV keeps you performing at your best. Get Body Armor Flash IV at your local 7-Eleven.
On this episode of Project Big Screen, we are doing our top 10 Spielberg movies, reviewing Disclosure Day, and we have an interview with Hugh Jackman and Michael Cernowski. Welcome to Project Big Screen, episode 37. Sorry for the delay. We've been going to extreme efforts to try and find a right time to record, but Dozen Week is like one of the most chaotic weeks of the company, so it's very hard to kind of get everything and everyone together and even find space and equipment and all that stuff. One of the beautiful things here at Barstool. But me, Clemmer, and Gooch are here to talk to you about Disclosure Day, the new Steven Spielberg movie. Anytime Spielberg comes into the box office, we're happy for it. And also, we're going to be doing our cumulative ranking is Steven Spielberg movies, which should be fun. And I'm interested because we have all five of our picks, right? We do have, I believe, Kirk's and Jeff's.
Yeah, we have them all. We have perfect. All their picks, and there are.
Oh no!
Oh dude, no, he's gotten taken over.
Oh no, Colin Firth!
Oh my God! We're also doing this in Stephen Shea's room, which Stephen Shea, you may not know if you're listening to this and only listen to us for like movie stuff, but a Barstool employee, one of our coworkers, who did call Disclosure Day one of the worst movie he's seen this year, or the worst movie he's seen of all time?
No, no. I think the worst movie of the decade is what he said.
The worst of the decade. Wow.
But he still gave it like a 3.6 or something. 3.1.
Maybe one of us think the same exact thing. So
I'm guessing not, but it should be fun. And the Spielberg ranking should be extremely fun too, just because we can convict both Jeff and Kirk and Absentina since they're not here to defend their opinions.
There are some misses on them. I'll say that much.
Oh, Jesus. All right, but before we get to that, let's talk about Disclosure Day. A cybersecurity expert becomes a whistleblower to reveal secrets about aliens, putting him on the run from a corporation, while a meteorologist experiences a strange phenomena and joins forces with him to prove that there is life beyond our knowledge. 2 hours, 25 minutes, Spielberg, Emily Blunt, Josh O'Connor, Colin Firth, Eve Houston, Coleman Domingo, Wyatt Russell. Opened up to almost $93 million worldwide, the largest opening ever for a Spielberg movie, which is kind of crazy, sitting at about 80% on Rotten Tomatoes, 73.
Right? Is that he hasn't had any movie open bigger?
No, this is like the fourth biggest opening for an original movie this decade. This is insane.
Inflation is up. We can note inflation is up.
Yeah, like, it's still really impressive.
No, I'm just kidding around.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's 74%.
People go to the movies, man.
There's a snowball. Yeah. Like I said, there's a snowball effect right now.
It's great.
It's great. Great, the best May and since pre-COVID, right? Since
this is
all
the best year since pre-COVID. Like I always, so every year since COVID, the box office is about $8 billion domestic.
Yeah,
It used to do 10. Yeah, we could get back to 10 this year.
Back to 10 without, and I will say, obviously we have Doomsday and Spider-Man this year, but it does feel we're not leaning on like IP for this stuff.
No, look at some of the movies that are blowing up.
Yeah.
You know, Backrooms, Obsession. These are Disclosure Day. These are original movies. If you're not excited, look, we'll have maybe opinions about Disclosure Day. If you're not excited about that trend, I don't know what to tell you.
It's great because it only enforces studios to want to make more original stuff and take more risks versus taking whatever the safest path to revenue is.
And it's risk where the directors are in charge again.
Yes. 74 on Metacritic, 3.3 on Letterboxd. So, Disclosure Day. I think you can kind of talk the pros, right? I think with Spielberg, what I get out of this movie, you get everything you love out of Spielberg, right? Where you get inventive camera work, you get chase scenes that nobody's doing in blockbusters now. And I think the thing that I loved the most about it is a trust in the audience that you do not get out of blockbusters anymore. Which, and what do you mean by that? Is like, you'll watch a movie now, like whether it's a Marvel movie, whether it's a Mission Impossible or like a big temple, a lot of the times they'll stop the sort of train. and they'll get out and they'll look the camera dead in the face and say, this is what's happening. Just got to reiterate it to you. This is why I'm feeling this way. This got to reiterate to you. You see, instead of giving you like context clues or like a little bit of clues for you to pick up and kind of solve stuff on your own, there's a lot of moments where he'll trust you as an audience member to figure shit out on your own. And if you don't, maybe you'll figure it out on rewatch. That's great. So that's something I think you get out of Spielberg here, which is awesome. I just feel that this one got a little bit mangled on the cutting room floor because he has a lot to say in it and just not enough time to say it. And I think that's where it ultimately kind of gets brought down a little bit for me. But what did you think, Clemmer?
Is that your review? What are you giving it?
That's just kind of like a primer, I'd say. I'm not going to give the score until we get more deeper into it.
Yeah, come on. Come on, Dad. Mom and Dad are away. Let the boys play. We can do things
our
own way.
We can do crazy things.
We can do our thing. We can do things our own way.
Wild. I'm at a 72 for this. This is the ultimate, is the glass half empty or half full movie. You're right, Kenjek, in that the high highs are there. That train scene is incredible. It's a really exciting train car sequence. It's perfect Spielberg. It just keeps heightening the just when you think they're safe, there's another element that makes it scary. Like, it's a really good scene, really well done. There's a lot that doesn't make sense here or just kind of falls flat. I mean, you have this World War III subplot that is totally unnecessary. And like you said, Ken Jack, was it left in the cutting room floor? I don't know. There's also movies 220. So I don't know what he thought you were making here. It's one of the dialogue's bad by the we're not going to give spoilers, but the villain ends up just not really being what you want in a villain. There's a lot wrong with this movie. You get a great Emily Blunt performance. I think, and she's not going to get nominated.
No, but say it.
In my opinion, this is an Oscar-worthy performance by her. She's that good. She won't get nominated, but she's that good in my book. But there's so much wrong with this movie, I can't say I love it. So I like it. 72.
72
from Clemmer.
I think I'm in the 70s as well. I'm trying, and this has been so tough for me because leaving the theater, I think I was very high, like up into the 80s, high 80s. But there just is problems at the script level. Like, there really are that, and you want to think about the movie because, like you said, Kinjack, it doesn't hold your hand, and it really brings some challenging stuff forward to you. And so you want to think about the movie afterwards, but once you start thinking about it, and I hate being the CinemaSins guy, I really hate when people like get on like any kind of minor plot holes or really try to pick apart a movie
that way.
But this movie has just problems with it that are tough to overlook. And we'll talk about more about them once we get to spoilers. But the highs, like you were mentioning, Clemmer, are so high. There's a point in the third act, and it's perfect Spielberg, perfect like old man relying on like old systems of the world. And it's so sentimental, and it worked on me. It worked on me. I was tearing up in the theater. It worked on me so well. So I am landing, I think I'm going to land at a 75. I think leaving the theater, I would have been at an 85. And I wonder where this will end up when I rewatch it, maybe 5 years from now, or maybe 5 months from now. Who knows? Maybe I'll rewatch it that soon. But 5 years, 10 years from now, I wonder how this ages, because Spielberg does have a habit of even his lesser stuff ages really, really well. But 75 out of 100. And I'm just ecstatic that we have a big blockbuster like this, even with all of its warts.
Mm-hmm. I think we can talk about a little bit about spoilers now. And I was kind of waiting. I wanted to see if you guys could bring me up from where I'm at. So my initial score is a 70. And I kind of want to be talked into grading it higher because I love Spielberg. But we can't do that. And I think that's maybe a problem I had trying to evaluate this movie, where like a lot of the stuff I had issues with, I'm like, oh, well, the script's maybe a little goofy here. The dialogue's maybe not great here. Like, but at the same time, we can't handhold Steven Spielberg. Nobody has more agency in making their movie than Steven Spielberg.
He was only 79 years old when he made this.
Yeah, it's like we can't like hold his hand and be like, oh, well, there's nothing he could do. Like, he's Steven fucking Spielberg. If he saw that this was wrong, something was wrong, he could have fixed it along the way. So like, we do need to be as critical as we can here, because he, more than anybody else, really has the full like creative control here. So I think the big problem is, and you mentioned this a little bit, Cooch, now that we're in spoilers, it really, really tests your suspension of disbelief, which is something you don't want in a movie. And it's something you want to do for a movie in general. Like, you don't, at least in my head, when I go into a movie, I'm not like searching for plot holes. I'm not searching for like, oh, well, in an alien movie, this should go this way and this should go that way. This wouldn't happen that way. Like, you're not. Like, you want your brain to be turned off and entertained. So like, you're giving them that. You're giving them that grace. And I really think like they just really push it. They really push it in a lot of sequences. And I think like, one of the big things that bothers me, and I'm curious how you guys felt about it, the Emily Blunt's big special power being indistinguishable from Oz the Mentalist, I think was lame. I think her, like, big power, like a cop pulls her over and says, she's like, yeah, well, I know your kids' names. You're going to let me go now? And he's like, yeah. It's like, what world does something like that happen and the cop doesn't immediately kill you? Like, you're like, I don't understand a lot of, like, the power stuff and this the MacGuffin rod thing where it's like the powers aren't defined other than they do it does exactly what the plot requires at that exact moment. I don't like either of that, especially compiled onto the other issues.
I don't mind the wand, but the way the wand is handled, the way they hold the wand in this movie, just straight out in front, like, it's just an awkward object, and it's not a very cinematic motion every time she uses it. So it, you think about it when she's using it. I think, and that is, but, like, her being able to empathize with people, like I said, the Spielberg schlockiness, the just schmaltziness, Klimmer, the schmaltziness really got to me. Like that, like, we, the Spielberg just saying, you know what the world needs? You know what will stop us from tearing each other apart? Empathy. Empathy. And her power just being able to empathize with people at an extraterrestrial level, really, I thought was awesome. I get what you're saying about the Oz, the Mentalist thing, but, like, I thought that ruled. I thought the invisibility ruled. It doesn't make sense. You're right. It really doesn't. And I think that if it had been presented in a different way other than that wand, I would have really loved it, and I think more people would have been on board with it. But that wand, just the way she holds, like, the wand, the way they hold that wand and the way it just looks bothered me.
And it also makes you wonder, like, how the fuck are the aliens constantly getting caught and dissected by humans nonstop? Like, they have this object that just seemingly does everything and anything. Like, how are they not getting away constantly? I don't know. It's just
so
a lot
the big
things.
The big flaw in this movie, I think we all agree, is the screenplay. It's very weak. Yeah. David Koepp. Yeah. And I need someone to explain David Koepp to me. Because I've never had more of a conflicted relationship with a screenwriter in my life.
He's the Adam Dunn of screenwriters.
It's all or nothing. You're absolutely right. This guy wrote Black Bag last year. But guess what? He also wrote that shitty Jurassic World movie last year. Like, yep. But he also wrote the original Jurassic Park, which is brilliant. But then he also wrote this, which is from a screenplay perspective, dog shit. Like, I don't know who this guy is. I don't know. When I say I'm for a David Koepp movie, I have no idea what I'm in for. It's a terrifying experience. He really does Spielberg a disservice here. Now, you're right. The way they hold the wand, that's obviously Spielberg directing that. But the fact that her powers are kind of nebulous to some extent, like, things just aren't. And this is a movie that's at odds with itself. Does it want to be the movie where it's an action-adventure movie? Or does it want to be what it is in the third act, which is what happens if we discover aliens are real? What does it want to be? And it doesn't seem to know, which is that's a black mark on Spielberg. He made a movie that doesn't know what it is. That's not good.
He's typically the opposite. I feel like he's pretty much a straight shooter throughout most of his career, regardless of what the movie is. Like, whether it's something as, like, you know, simple as The Post or whatever, or doing Jurassic Park, or, like, it could be Saving Private Ryan, whatever. He's very, very direct, and everything is simply, like, pretty, I would say, succinctly done with purpose. And it doesn't feel like that here. It's like, well, I want to say a little bit about religion. Well, I want to say a little bit about empathy. Well, I want to say a little bit about the human existence. Well, I want to say a little bit about this. Like, well, you either need to expand the movie then. It can't be 2 hours, 20 something minutes, because not only are you doing a disservice to your own plot, but you're doing a disservice to your actors, especially the tertiary ones. Like, Eve Hewson and Wyatt Russell get nothing to work with here.
I'll go a step further. Josh O'Connor, I love him. And it's not a bad performance.
It's not.
What the fuck is that character supposed to be? What is his character supposed to be?
It's irrelevant. You don't need to have him in the movie.
You don't. Yeah. And to your point, Klimmer, it completely undermines, I think, what he's going for at the end, where he, I mean, I don't know if it's explicitly supposed to be a sexual assault, like a childhood sexual abuse thing, but at the very end, it just gets resolved in the strangest way. Like, it's very clear that he's, like, reliving this, like, traumatic thing. And meanwhile, we have Emily Blunt, and they just accept the alien when the big fucking huge alien, by the way, the fucking massive alien enters the room. He's like, I know you. I understand you. Minutes after he's reliving this, what is very clearly like a very traumatic experience.
Yeah.
Like, don't go with them. They're not animals. They're not animals. They're not animals. And then he's just fine. It's so strange. Do you think Josh O'Connor and Eve Houston ever fucked, or what? Like, what was their relationship?
They met that day.
Clearly says, "I'm not a nun. We had sex." She does say that to him.
I don't believe them. I don't like
her character was fucking useless. Like both her and White Russell, like I get White Russell gets some like comedic timing in there. Like every single time that they showed up on screen, I'm like, what are you still doing here? Like you what are you doing other than like getting side object 10 to point B? Like, you know what I mean? Like I just, every time they were on screen, it just bothered me. Cause like you have two big stars here. You have Blunt and you have O'Connor. Like let them do their thing. I really don't need to see anything from them. And honestly, to the same degree, the, and I don't know how you guys felt about them. They like, pseudo government agency thing with Colin Firth, I thought was a huge dud. Huge dud. And like,
it's horrible. Yeah, what, Colin Firth at the end of the movie just sits down. He's like,
just sit down and like,
eh. Yeah, you know, I
he
lost.
Got me.
Yep. Like, what kind of villain is that? Also, like, if we're going to do this whole thing, like, all right, there's a whole agency that's like, I guess, like a private agency that the government enlisted to do this. There's so many people involved. This, like, at some point, you have to, like you said, this, you know, You almost have to totally just acknowledge reality doesn't exist because someone would have leaked this. And then when you have someone who's going to leak it, there's like, well, don't put it on the internet.
You got to
tell local news.
That's where when I started, that was the first thing I thought of leaving the theater when I really started to think about the movie that, you know, when it started to come down for me was, well, I was like, why didn't he just go public with this shit? What was
he's a cybersecurity maestro, but he's never heard of WikiLeaks. Like he would throw this shit online somewhere.
Because no. Spielberg, this is where he's just old. He has so much faith in like media and the power of the news. He's like, if it's on the internet, nobody will believe it. But if it's run by CBS and ABC and NBC, then people will know that this is real. And they're going to fact check it really quickly for us so we know that it's real. when they start throwing that shit on the screen and while they were filming it was like, hey, Steven, do you think they would maybe fact check this before? And he's like, why don't we have someone say, we checked it for AI. It's real.
Yeah.
It's a grainy black and white footage. Like, that. Like we've all seen way better AI deepfakes than those pictures. Like, what are we doing? So at some point, like, that... like the straw that broke the camel's back. At some point, like I was like, I just don't believe what I'm seeing anymore, and that's kind of a shame.
Yeah, but I will say when the news does start kicking in, it worked for me. When that news anchor, and she is a real news anchor in real life.
Yes, it was cool.
I can't remember her name off the top of my head right now, but she, I mean, Judd Hirsch gave a 3-minute performance that people were banging the drum for a supporting acting nom a few years ago in The Fabelmans for Spielberg. I thought she was just as good. Like, she gets on screen and delivers one of the best, like, 3-minute punches while she's just sitting there reacting to what she's seeing on screen. That's what really, really moved me. Like, really worked, I thought.
Yeah, that was old school movie making magic when, like, everything starts changing and, like, all the other stations start swapping to it. And, like, we talked about this, I think, with Robbie Fox a little bit too. The cut to black versus going like one more step further, I do think was smart, but also, it did leave me wanting more in a bad way, where I'm like, well, I do, like, now I think the more interesting part of this is seeing the next step, like what happens.
Well, that's what that movie was marketed as, too. Like, so what is this movie supposed to be? Is it supposed to be action-adventure, or is it supposed to be what happens if aliens are real? And it seems like everybody wanted the latter, and we didn't get it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it does...
Yeah, it's kind of...
I mean, does he get there with that, though? Like, what would happen is just he's... Is he just so optimistic that he truly believes that, and he does believe aliens are real? And you know what? Fuck it. I do too. But
I think there's something out there. I don't know if they're necessarily, I don't think they've maybe been on Earth yet, but there's so many stars.
But does he believe truly that is like enough of an event that would bring the world together for us to put our guns down?
I think we do the opposite.
Exactly. And I think I'm fairly optimistic when it comes to these things, but. You gotta at least address it. At least address it, I think.
Half the world want to attack the aliens, half the world wouldn't want to attack the aliens. It would be a nightmare.
It would be, you know, is a great way to kind of like figure out the next step of this is watch District 9. I think District 9 did a good job of like what would happen if like they actually crash landed a bunch of aliens on Earth. I think that's what would happen. What happened in District 9.
We just find somebody else to be racist against.
Yeah, just be apartheid against. It'd be apartheid against aliens, more or less. But I do think we're being like obviously very negative, but there were a lot of positives here.
There
I would
were
say for sure.
No, like the magic is here. Like there are sequences in this movie that are just like top tier. Spielberg.
That train car sequence is about as good as the sequence you're going to get in any movie all year.
The car coming
everything
through the
leading
house?
Into that. The tracking Josh O'Connor like running through that field and everything. Like I don't know how the fuck he did that. Like I have no clue. And like seeing just a well lit house, seeing like good colors, seeing like just everything that you would see not in a blockbuster anymore, in a blockbuster, I think is just so refreshing. Which I guess you do need to give it credit for.
I also like the Colin Firth when he took over. What was it, Eve Houston?
Eve Houston. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like when he took Spano's over daughter. Her. Like I felt like that was actually kind of. Now they, I think they maybe did it one too many times for me. But the first time I did it, when the eyes changed color, I'm like, I'm kind of in on this.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Or when she's in the back seat taking over, and then she's got that knife. Yeah. And you get that quick like Hitchcockian like reflection of the knife. That's just great old school movie magic. Like really, yeah. Just well done stuff. Mm-hmm. That's what works. Really? Like that's why this movie isn't a complete disaster.
Blunt was so. I don't think we have given that Blunt enough flowers. Blunt was so good in this.
I think this is, and I was like, is this their best since Sicario? And I really thought about it. I think this is her best performance.
She's really good in A Quiet Place.
She is, but this is like she's all over the map
she's
emotionally.
Really good here,
and
man.
Just really carries the movie.
Yeah,
she's very good at being like I think what we would be in that same situation, just like suddenly. Like you're feeling and seeing everything in the world, like you know what I mean, like that's a very I would assume overwhelming experience.
I also love that it's not all negative. Like she has some enthusiasm about it. Like she's kind of excited about this happening, but also like scared. She kind of wears it all on her face and does and just makes it like you said, Kendrick. Like it feels like really earnest and real.
Yeah. So I think that we're all roughly around the same spot.
What are you at with
it? I'm sticking with the 70. All I'm trying to think of like more things I really liked about it. I'm sticking with the 70. Gucci, you're at a 75. I'm trying to think of what else like was really, really great about it.
I like how it opened. Just,
the opener's great.
Like,
that's
again,
trust.
Just heavy-handed as fuck. Like the red versus the blue. Like he's very clear. Like the whole way through, very heavy-handedly. Like this is the real world. Like this is a very clear allegory for what's going on in our world. Like just people fighting on both sides. And I don't know. That works for me. It does, if it's handled well, and I think he did, and I love the way it just drops you straight in.
The Coleman Domingo part was so worthless.
Worthless.
Yeah, that was
and pointless. I love the actor, but man, oh man, that whole thing was just there's so many wasted characters here, but then you also, like you guys are saying, like Robbie Fox, our coworker, he was like, this should have been a Netflix, like, 8-part series. I'm like, you're exactly right. Like, this needed more time to get these ideas out there. Like, the religion stuff, which is kind of brush over. Like, we need more time.
Yeah, like, what's her name? The Elizabeth Marvel character. Like, yeah, but also she was a nun. And also, like, she's saying maybe aliens were real underneath God's creation. It's like, okay, we need more time to sit with stuff like that. Like, we just needed a lot more time.
Yes.
And I don't know if that comes in a director's cut down the line or maybe what. But, there are ideas here that work. It's just there's too many ideas happening all at once, which is frustrating because, again, Spielberg seems to be, at least in my head, somebody who's had that figured out forever, like very concise messaging, very concise storytelling. And this is not very concise. It's very unfocused, I would say. So a little bit of a bummer. But overall, the movie that if I was going to say, hey, if someone asked me, like, hey, should I go see Disclosure Day? I'd say, yeah. Like,
I recommend this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It just
I don't love it, but I'd recommend it.
Just the blockbusterness of it all, like the well-made blockbuster movie making of it all is worth seeing on the big screen for sure. Mm-hmm. He's doing a Western next. Who would you guys want to see in that? Who would you cast as a lead in a Spielberg Western? Right
you know,
now?
It's, you know who I would have cast before this movie? Josh O'Connor.
Mm. Yeah.
He has that like world. I just feel like he has that kind of look where I believe him existing in 1880.
Yeah,
I do not in America. Yeah, I believe him existing in England. Okay. Like he has one of the most English faces on the planet, which is another little, very minor complaint for me. Was like, is Emily Blunt very British? If Houston looked like she was straight out of a period piece, like straight up, and like same thing with Josh O'Connor, just like they're painfully English in what is supposed to be or Irish in her case, painfully that in a movie that's supposed to be Heartland USA, Kansas City, like yeah. So I don't know that very minor complaint, very very minor. But yeah, Josh, I don't know who I'd want in a Hanks, Chet.
Chet Hanks. Come on, baby.
He's a good actor. He's got some juice.
Is there anyone young right now that Spielberg has? Like, who is a good? This is the problem with Spielberg casting right now. It's not even a problem, but it's just like I would love to see him get back together with a major star. It's been a while.
Who's like a good grizzled actor? like that could be in that. You know what I mean? I don't want like another like, because you know they've made westerns with like Cody Smith McPhee. Like, I mean, I don't want no soft westerns.
We're gonna talk about Catch Me If You Can in a second.
Yeah.
Reunite with Leo.
I'd love that.
Man,
yeah, they haven't
worked,
that.
They haven't worked together in 20 years.
Tom Hanks did that. Was it News of the World kind of recently too?
Oh, that was not. I don't know why, man. I was living a nice life the last few months, not remembering that movie existed. Why'd you do that to me?
So that's Disclosure Day. I think we can do a quick hit on The Furious because me and Clemmer both saw it. The Furious, I would just say for me, it was and I know Clemmer, we're a little bit on opposite ends of this. I'm in a 90 out of 100 on The Furious because I think it accomplishes everything it is sets out to do, which is deliver the best fights possible. And to me, the third act fight scene is like, that's the best fight scene I've seen this century. It is so fucking good. It's unbelievable. You got five of the best martial art actors in the world, all with five different styles, all just fucking slamming it out in some of the best action choreography you're going to see all year. Plot definitely thin. It's taken, but it's just better because the actors can actually fight. But the fights are what you're there for, and the fights are fucking unbelievable. Brian Lay in particular, who's just like this immortal gorilla character, is so fucking good. Really liked it. Obviously, we did the video with Joe Taslim too, which I would highly recommend. He was an absolute gem, so fun to work with, and we had the interview with him last week. And yeah, so I would say if you want to watch something other than Disclosure Day, go watch The Furious. It'll blow your shit off. But Clemmer?
Yeah, I'm at a 70, but let me say that. Let me put an asterisk there. I'm not a fight movie guy, so this is probably the ceiling. So my 70 is almost like 100, if you will, in the fight, because it's not why I go to the movies. I'm a big story and character guy, and this movie is not built. It was never created to do that. So I almost feel like inadequate giving a review of this movie because I'm not coming from a fair point. This is why even when I did my Crouching review, I had Ken Jack with me because I'm like, Ken Jack loves fight movies. He can speak to them. He appreciates them. He understands what makes them tick, what makes them good. The fight scenes, to me, are really incredible in this movie, and it makes you kind of go, wow. But that's not going to be, like, my ultimate draw. But I was still entertained. I'm not a fight movie guy, and I was still, like, I wasn't, like, shifting in my seat. I was still blown away by some of these stunts. It's an incredible work of art they do. It's just not necessarily the work of art that I go for. But if you even, like, moderately like fight movies, I can't recommend this enough. This is a really well-crafted thing that they do.
And the star of the movie punched Clemmer in the face on video. Very
cool.
He did.
He got me. No, I mean, couldn't have been a more of a, like, I don't know, like, I don't say humble. Like, just so kind. Like, he was like, because we were, you know, rehearsing this stuff. He had patience with us. But he never came off as like, a few of the guys who aren't movie guys didn't even know that he was a star. But like, is he just a stuntman? No, he's the star. He's one of the great fight actors of our generation. And he comes off as just one of the guys. Couldn't have been a better gentleman with us.
Massive star, by the way. Like, has millions of followers.
Yes.
And I mean, obviously not on this side of the world, but a huge, huge, huge star.
But never acted like it with us at all. So,
no, very normal guy. Like, guy. Even afterwards, like after we were all done fighting, like the guy who ran the judo gym we were at is like, can you just give me a few tosses? And he was like, yeah, sure. So he just like started like literally manhandling the guy that ran our gym. It was so cool.
Well, the noises that they made when he threw him down, it sounded like the world was ending. It was crazy.
Yeah, that's like the difference between like stunt fighting like a Tom Cruise or whatever and him who was like an actual judo champion like on the national team for Olympics and shit. So like that's where you get like the difference between acting in somewhat real.
So we were all having a debate after we shot that thing. It was like, I don't know, say 12 of us guys. And someone's like, you know, do you think if we all rushed him, we could take him? And there was like a debate. Like some people, including me, was like, no way this guy would destroy us with his pinky. I'd be like, I don't know, if we all rushed him. And I guess Fights, our coworker, heard him, just kind of chuckled to himself. This, and then after seeing this movie, this guy would have annihilated us with a blindfold on and no arms, just his legs. And he would have just destroyed us. This is an incredible, incredible guy. Incredible movie if you like fights.
Yeah, definitely check it out.
I give it a 70, but oh, like that's my ceiling. Yeah. I feel bad doing that, and feel free to put an asterisk on there, just because I'm not a fight movie guy. Like, but even so, I guess that speaks volumes to it. Don't love fight movies? I still recommend this movie.
Hell yeah.
There is a third act, like split screen moment with a thunderclap. How fucking great was that?
Yeah, they do like really, really creative stuff. Makes you chuckle along the way too with some of the stuff, and the scenes do such a good job like heightening of each other. But you're a big fight guy, like, and you would talk to me afterwards, like, oh, they have different styles and stuff. I don't have the eye for that, so I don't see that. But if you appreciate these things, you need to see this movie right away.
Yeah, very good movie. Now we can talk about some other stuff, including a lot of the trailers that we hadn't had a chance to talk about yet, including The Social Reckoning. I don't know if you guys heard, but I got 100 million on Facebook.
Yeah, 100 million on Facebook.
You got 100 million on Facebook. I'm not sure if you saw that clamor on the trailer.
I did. I had to play it back like 4 times. But then it's funny. Once you know what it says, then you hear it easily.
Yes, which is so weird. It's like an illusion or something. Like,
yeah, what a weird trick.
Yeah. An audio illusion. Aaron Sorkin directing this time. He obviously wrote The Social Network, which is directed by Fincher. Companion piece to Social Network follows Francis Haugen, the young Facebook engineer who enlists the help of Jeff Horowitz, a Wall Street Journal reporter, to blow the whistle on the social network's most guarded secrets. Jeremy Allen White, Jeremy Strong, Mikey Madison, Bill Burr, among others, October 8th, 2026. Trailer-wise, I think I have the same issues or worries I had with this before seeing the trailer, which is just, I don't think Sorkin is a strong director. He is a very accomplished writer, and I think the thing that makes him a good writer is having consistently, like, directors who will curb his instincts and, like, say, this is not a great idea. Let's tone this down. Let's maybe add a little subtlety here. Like, he needs a muse to max out his scripts, and when he doesn't, you kind of get Trial of Chicago 7, which is what I'm thinking here, only because you're touching base with stuff politically, and that's where I get really worried with Sorkin, because I don't know what it is, like, his brain just can't do subtlety anymore, and
he never was a good director.
But that's the thing with, like, that's why you need, like, someone, a good director, to kind
of,
like, curb that,
of course,
right? Because he can write the dialogue.
Give me Rob Reiner. Give me, you know, you obviously can't have Rob Reiner anymore, sadly. But, like, look what he did with, like, you know, Jesus, A Few Good Men. Well, he's dead. Fincher, guess what? He's dead. I mean, you know, it happened. But, like, he was such a brilliant director. Because you know what Rob Reiner did, too, with his work? And I feel like this is what Sorkin needs. Brings the humanity to it. Brings, like, this, like, for some reason, Sorkin can't direct characters. Like, it's so odd. I don't know what this is about with him. But it's awful, and it ruins these movies.
You know what I feel like he does, and I don't know if you would agree with me here. It feels like he makes every character a reflection of himself, and, like, that, I think, is what kind of makes them all kind of bland to me, because it feels like he views himself talking as that person. And I feel like you kind of even can see that in this, and I'm not super pumped with it. I'm kind of excited for whatever the fuck. Like Jeremy Strong, I think, has got it. He got the look down. He got the voice down. The other guys, people are just kind of playing themselves, I guess. But
I don't know,
like,
about the look.
I don't know about the look either.
I think he kind of looks like him as much as Jeremy Strong could possibly look like Mark Zuckerberg. Like, I think he looks like him.
I have a hard...
Listen, I'm here for it. Like, I'm here for whatever the fuck Jeremy Strong is going to do here. Like, that's the big selling point for this movie, I think. But
Maybe 5 minutes in, that can also go away quick.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to... That's why... trailers are trailers. I don't know. I don't know. I have no. This didn't move the stock up or down for me.
It moved it down for me.
Down.
It moved it down because I was holding out just a sliver of hope that this could be not what I was expecting. But it's just like all the worst tendencies are here. You can just see it. You can see it. And obviously, we have to see the movie. Maybe the trailer is not representative of that. But
yeah.
But like fucking hell. Like the Mikey Madison character. I can. What is she in the trailer with? What does she say? She says something so fucking stupid. No, it's like...
No, she does say something stupid. I forget what it is.
Fuck. It's right before they kick in the Reznor and Ross score, like it's the Avengers theme. Which
it's like a line doing, where
They're not doing the score.
They're not?
Fuck. No. No, they're not.
What are we doing? Why is this...
No, she gives a techie line that's like very much like... I forget what it is, but fuck. It's good, though.
Fuck,
and like the
I think I gotta
Billy Magnuson being like... We're post-government around here.
Like, why are we doing this movie?
It's also just not that interesting. Like, to me, like if your big selling point is like a psychologist being like, yeah, like little girls look at themselves more negatively now because of Facebook. Okay, log off. Like I, that's not very compelling to me as a viewer anyway. Like, you need, what's great about Social Network is you see all this building of like this Goliath. Like, this isn't even a dismantling. Like Facebook and Meta is still around, still kicking it. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, like, to me, at least, not that compelling.
Hold on. It's not, she doesn't say it. Hold on. Billy Magnuson goes, I don't know what the girl thinks she's doing. Jeremy Allen White, long pause. She's disrupting.
Oh, yeah.
She's disrupting. Right, that was it. Yep. Yeah. God, that's such a fucking Sorkin line, like,
that
from
is,
like 2012.
Yep.
Oh.
God, just not into it. But yeah, that's the social reckoning. Heart of the Beast, after a harrowing plane crash, Special Forces officer James Belmont and his combat dog Odin find themselves stranded deep in the Alaskan wilderness. Together, they must fight a brutal fight for survival against the elements, directed by David Ayers, who did End of Watch, Fury, among many other things, including the dog shit Suicide Squad, which he has spoken out against. Stars Brad Pitt and J.K. Simmons. I'll say this is like a very slop movie, it looks like, for sure, just watching it. When the dog bared its fangs and they were silver, I was a little bit in. Like, I was like, okay, I'm kind of a little bit interested. But other than that, like, it just kind of like, it's a very, looks very whatever to me.
My girlfriend was unable to go see Disclosure Day with me, and this trailer played before Disclosure Day. It was the first time I'd seen it. First time I'd ever heard of this movie.
Me too, same.
And I was trying to explain this movie to her. I was like, you don't understand. The dog has PTSD. The dog has PTSD, yeah. And like wakes up with they have like the dog dreaming about like bombs Iraq, going off in like Baghdad. And it wakes up. I'm sorry. I'm sure dogs can have PTSD.
Yeah, dogs dream. My dog dreams.
Absolutely. It's just something.
My dog's running in their dreams.
It feels like a fake movie. It certainly feels like a fake movie, a 30 Rock movie, a Tropic Thunder movie. Like it feels like one of those where you're like, is this an Oscar play for Brad Pitt? Like, I couldn't really. It's got to be dad slot, but are they trying to go for something more elevated here also? Because it is a very serious, like, they play it straight in that trailer. They play it as straight as possible.
You guys are going to laugh at me. So I'm a big dog guy.
Of course.
Also, I don't know what's going on me lately. The kid on the way or whatever, but I started to get like choked up watching this trailer.
Yes, of course.
Is that okay?
Yes.
Animals are a cheat code. No, when it comes
you're
to
like, you don't even watch movies where dogs get hurt, right? Are you even going to be able to watch this?
I was like, I mean, I'll go see it, obviously, I'm kind of nervous, and it's also going to come out like right like 2 weeks after my kid's born, so like I'm going to just be like an emotional, I think, just like jellyfish. So I don't know, like I might just need to see this movie like by myself and like just sit in a corner and just cry.
Dog has a prosthetic paw.
I can't deal. This is gonna like destroy me.
Mm-hmm. He drags him out of the water. What is it? Like, does he have a heart attack on the plane? What exactly?
Yeah, he has like some sort of like, he, like passes out on the plane. He has some problems. Yeah,
but he like grabs his arm and then
I
goes
know.
Down.
I bet he has a heart attack in the plane. But, oh my god!
Yeah, but then
the dog is poor. Dog's crying.
Yeah, yeah, that was tough. But yeah, that's Heart of the Beast. Whale Fall.
Here's an animal falls movie.
Here we go.
Another animal movie. Falls Here a scuba diver go. Who, while searching for the remains of his father, gets swallowed alive by a whale and attempts to escape. Directed by Brian Duffield, who did No One Will Save You on Hulu, which was a very solid alien movie, actually, with Caitlin Dever. Stars Austin Abrams, who is a star out of Weapons and now is doing Resident Evil as well. It also stars Josh Brolin. I think it's a cool concept. I think it was an interesting trailer. They gave you nada, which is great. I'm very interested. I would say, at least in the horror, suspense, thriller world, like you'd feel like you don't get a ton of super original concepts. Like this is, I think, is very interesting. And you could say whatever, Joan and the Whale, whatever bullshit. This is very interesting to me. I think it's unique and I'm into it.
I'm very in on this. Very, very, very in on this movie. I like this trailer plays and I sit up. It's one of those trailers where every single time I've seen it so far, I'm like, oh, fuck. Like Austin Abrams, too. Like, I'm just in on this guy.
Let's go, guy in a whale. Let's go. I'm here. I'm here for it. That just sounds fun as fuck.
That's just an old-timey tale.
Let's just get a guy in a whale. That sounds awesome.
Like, that's got to be like one of the oldest stories we still tell. Yes. Was a guy getting swallowed by a whale. Like,
I kind of want to see a guy in a whale. I want
to
see a guy.
He wasn't trying to escape. He wanted to stay there. Or did he? I forget. I don't remember my Bible.
I don't know about the science behind it. But
yeah, I don't either. I kind of want to see a guy in a whale.
Fuck it.
That sounds cool.
Very interesting. We got to Photoshop him into Brendan Fraser, like falling into Brendan Fraser's stomach. We should have done that when it came out. I don't know how we didn't.
Which
think of that
whale
before.
Is smellier, you think? Brendan Fraser, right?
Well, at least you're not like you're sitting in his stomach and all of a sudden you just hear him jacking off to gay porn while you're like in his stomach.
Should I leave it at the door?
Dude, it's so unintentionally funny in retrospect. But anyway, that's Whale Fall. Gatto. This follows Nero, a scrappy black cat who is in debt to a feline mob boss. He forms an unexpected friendship that helps him along find his true purpose. Directed by Enrico Casarosa, who did Luca, which was kind of a bummer on a Pixar. The two big voice actors in this are Mark Ruffalo and Lawrence Fishburne. I think it's one of the ultimate, just like, fine, looks fine.
Yeah.
Looks okay. Like, I'm more excited for another Pixar movie coming soon than I am for this by a huge margin.
Yeah, I don't know what they're doing right now. I mean, the animation style looks... I like the animation style a lot. Like, it looks like they're... I mean, maybe it's just because there's no humans in it, but I've hated their human character designs for, like, a decade now because they just have that weird post-Frozen look to them where everybody's got a tiny nose and huge eyes and just a weird look to the characters. And these are cats, and I like the way they're kind of scrangly and, you know, look funny. But yeah, this just doesn't do much for me, but the animation style is a step in the right direction for them, I think.
Yeah.
Like, that's a major, like, that's just a major piece of making an animated movie is you got to catch my attention for 90 minutes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This was like, and this is, sounds shitty, but this is like, it's a cartoon. Like, you know, like, I don't care. And, like, I know it's shitty because, like, Hopper is, like, for instance, came out this year and it had, like, a really fun, memorable scene in it. And, like, there's some certain takeaways. Zootopia 2 was like was decent, but Zootopia 1 was like a lot to take from. So there are cartoons that break through. This to me felt like I don't know, it's a cartoon, I don't care. Like it's also like anytime they dealt with like the mob stuff or like adult themes, it just doesn't really click for me because it feels so, and it is, it's so like, you know, muted and it's safe. So it's like it's hard to tell like an adult story when you're gonna defang it. I don't know. I don't care.
Is it though? Mm-hmm. Is it?
I think so.
Well, you could say the same thing with Soul. I think they had that issue with Soul, where like adults liked it, but kids just didn't resonate with it.
Yeah, but then they can do like Hamlet. Like they can do Hamlet with the Lion King, and it's fucking immaculate. Like,
that's
it might
true.
Be the best Shakespearean adaptation.
You're not wrong like, with that. But, but on the flip side, though, like a mob story in like modern times,
like heavily reskinned.
You got to kill people in the mob. These cats aren't going to kill anyone. We're
getting into anti-Italian territory, and I don't appreciate it.
Oh, that's perfect.
Come on.
Out of Italian. Kind of racism. Out of it. Don't tell. Is Dante in the office right now?
Come on. This is just because of the Knicks one, isn't it?
I just saw him yesterday. Yeah.
Dante. Oh yeah, no, yeah. Don't, we can't bring in Dante. Right
we can't bring him. We'll be here for an hour. Shrek 5 teaser trailer. Shrek is a weird franchise where I think after Shrek 2, I was like, all right, I get it. And I wasn't really into it. And then Puss in Boots comes along and the Last Wish is just a fucking banger. And I'm like, okay, maybe I could use a little more Shrek in my life. I do think watching this teaser, there's not a lot here where I'm like, whoa, this is going to be cool. This looks interesting. But also, I think I would have said the same thing back in 10 years ago about Puss in Boots. So it's the ultimate, like, I'm just going to wait and see. Maybe it's great. Maybe they do have something unique and interesting to say like they did in Puss in Boots. So, and have heart, which is something that sometimes feels missing in animated movies. And I feel like if they get that, then I'm in.
Yeah, I thought this looked terrible, though. Like, really fucking bad. Like, disastrous, almost. I almost wish that they would Sonic this thing. Because I hate the way they look terrible. I don't know what it is. The early 2000s clanky animation style looked way better. Maybe it's just me getting older and just holding on to things from my childhood, but I really do not like the way new Shrek looks in the new ogres look. The broccoli haircut kid, what are we doing?
The broccoli haircut kid. They did that in your favorite movie, though. Hold on.
Yeah, but that makes sense. That makes sense.
Why does it make sense in Avatar, but it doesn't make sense in Shrek?
Well, they're Polynesian. They're standing for the Polynesian community.
Polynesians are known for their broccoli
for their
haircut now?
Curly hair. Yes.
But what ogres aren't?
I grew up with Ray Malaluga. He had curly hair, long curly hair.
But not fucking ogres?
It looks weird on an ogre.
Troy Polamalu.
It looks...
Palomalu, yeah.
Troy Polamalu did like shampoo commercials. He's so known for his hair.
Hmm. Wasn't no,
I
here,
also like I didn't. The jokes were also not hit.
The jokes
for me.
Suck. Shrek sucks.
No, the
we
first
all,
Shrek
we
is
all
funny.
Pretend.
No.
You guys like Shrek because you grew up with it. I don't give a fuck about Shrek. Shrek blows.
The first
Shrek one,
one
is great.
Shrek sucks.
The first one's funny.
No, Shrek it's one funny didn't make if you laugh? See it when you're like four and you're if you see it when you're 24 the first time,
that.
It's not funny.
But it's just a satire.
It's not funny.
It's just a complete satire of like all these like fairy tales.
Crazy.
That we grew up with. It was kind of crazy. Like what else did that?
It wasn't crazy. It was stupid.
Name another movie.
They didn't make you
that.
Laugh at all.
No.
You didn't like the soundtrack. No. You didn't like any of it.
No, I hate the soundtrack. The original Monkey song is better. Smash Mouth ruined a pretty good Monkey song.
Smash Mouth is not the only artist on that soundtrack. It is littered with just bangers.
You guys love it because you grew up with it. I understand that. I probably have the same connection to things that I grew up with that you guys would have no connection to. I understand all that. Speaking to someone who was 22 when it came out, fuck Shrek.
So you don't like, I mean, man, the soundtrack really is just a lot. There's Proclaimers. There's Eddie Murphy, I'm a believer. I forgot about that.
Right.
Joan Jett, Leslie Carter, Baha Men. Man, whatever.
The Baha Men. Sure. Oh, you're really making your case.
Oh, Baha Men are good. You don't like Who Let the Dogs Out? They just won the Knicks title.
Who Let the Dogs Out? Mike Brown is dancing on your grave right now.
You know what that song's about?
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's what makes it good. Woke Clemmer trying to denounce the Baha Men.
Fuck Shrek. I'm so tired of Shrek. Wish Shrek could go away. I would pay $400 right now to live in a world where Shrek never existed. Like cash.
I was at a zero.
How would that be?
I was at a zero on Shrek.
If I never had to see or hear millennials like rave about Shrek the rest of my life, I would pay $400 cash right now to live in a Shrek-free world.
But it's like handed down. It's been handed down. Like Gen Z fucks with Shrek.
$400 is a better investment then. I'm tired of it. Like tired of Shrek.
I will say I am shocked that it has lived past our generation. I am surprised by that. But it's huge. It is huge. I'd say it's bigger with Gen Z than it is with millennials.
That can't be the case because you people are.
It's like a memeified thing, big time. Shrek.
I understand. I once again, why I would pay the money.
Poor Shrek. We can talk about some news now. Just a few quick hitters. First one being 24 Jump Street is in the works. Great, fantastic. Shame it took this long, but also to a degree in my head, I'm like, is Jonah Hill funny anymore?
I know.
After watching Outcome, after watching some recent stuff, I'm like, does Jonah Hill still have the juice for something like this? Channing Tatum definitely does. He's still got it. If anything, he's proven that he not only originally had that comedic level of whatever talent, but also he can do serious too. Not that that's
Roofman. He was fantastic.
Yeah, and now I'm just kind of like, let's see, can they kind of dust this off for this? I don't know, but I'm very interested. And obviously, it would have to be the full uniting crew back. I believe Lord Miller would be back. So yeah, I'm very in on that.
Also, maybe this is what Jonah Hill needs, though. Back to basics.
I know.
Back to basics.
Mm-hmm. I'll say this. If this can't save him, nothing can.
Mm.
I don't hate that take. I really don't. He just needs to, and this sounds so mean and like body shaming, he needs to put some weight back on. Like, it's at the end of the
day.
He's not a skinny guy. He's not a skinny guy.
Let skinny people can be funny, too. We're trying out here.
They can be.
No, it's true.
Not all skinny people.
Yeah. There's many such cases of this, of fat guy's funnier when he's fat. It is what it is.
By the way, do you think they do, like, because obviously at the end of, do you know this, like, the end of 22 Jump Street, they do the credits are, like, all the potential sequels they would have done. Like, I think 23 would have been med school vet school or something like that. And then 24 was the Russian, they go to, like, Russian CIA training or something.
That's
or
funny.
Some kind of Russian school. I don't know. Yeah. I hope they do the Russian thing, though.
I'd be very interested. You mentioned Pixar earlier. The Toy Story 5 reviews are great. They're fantastic. And
well, lowest in the franchise.
Yeah, was that?
Lowest in the franchise, though.
Lowest, respectively, to any other franchise. It's still like higher than anything else. I will say a lot of the reviews I've seen, and a lot of the early ones, right? And we've talked about this ad nauseum. Like, it's a lot of people get invited because they give good reviews, because they're very kind to the movie.
Right.
But a lot of the people that I've seen who are typically not those people, who are typically like pretty like level-headed to negative, have been saying like, this is one of their better sequels. It had something to say. It's interesting. It's unique. It's more than just a money grab, which to me is very like a little more promising than I was earlier, where I'm just like, hey, it might just be another good movie like Toy Story 4 that doesn't really do anything other than kind of spoil the ending of Toy Story 3, which is a phenomenal ending to a franchise. So I'm a little bit more on the, I would say, optimistic side for Toy Story 5 now.
I'm sure it'll be good. Yeah. Like, it'll be good.
It'll be good.
But Toy Story 4 had nothing to say, right? Like, it's a good movie with nothing to say.
That's
if
okay
this one
too,
has
though,
something.
Right? Like, I don't know. Like, who cares? Like, you know, if you can put out, like, a good quality kids movie, like, I personally don't care about the integrity of the Toy Story, like, trilogy. Like as long as it's a good kids movie that, like, families can bring their kids to a quality film, let's go.
It's less that I care about the integrity of the franchise, and it's more that I know Pixar has their A-team bundled up in this franchise, and I would like to see them do something else, to be
honest.
That's
a fair take.
Like, they have their best animators, their best storyboarders, their best writers, like, their best voice actors. All their best are working on the toy, and I get it. It's a cash cow. Makes millions and billions
of
dollars.
Oh, billions of dollars.
Billion. They got a theme park. They got everything. Yep. It merchandises well still, but I'm just done with the franchise. I mean, I'll go see this movie, and I'm sure I'm going to like it. It's just, am I going to love it? You know, yeah. am I going to want to rewatch it? I rewatched the first two a couple weeks ago. Excuse me. And man, they hold up. They hold up.
Even Toy Story 1 holds up really well. I rewatched it, I don't know, about a year ago. I was like, wow, this is impressive.
You forget how funny it is, too.
Yeah.
Like the Rip Torn, the Rip Torn, the little toy soldiers fucking kill me when they're on like the recon mission and one of them like bust his legs. And he's just like, no, I'm not leaving you behind, soldier.
R.I.P. Rip Torn. I was just talking to somebody about Defending Your Life the other day. God, he's so good. He was so
good.
Oh,
it's such a good movie.
Such a great movie. Speaking of late sequels, Mike Myers said Austin Powers 4 is like, he said it's happening. I just can't give any more details on it yet.
I don't know if we need that.
I like Austin Powers a lot, and I do think that there's enough there to do something funnier than Scary Movie for sure.
I think that's
not a fair comp though.
But would they? The question parody is, movie. Would they still stick to parodying the old school espionage of like the?
Yeah,
because they were like obviously parodying like the Connery Bonds and the Dalton and
yeah, the Moore Bonds really, yeah, right? Yeah, the Dalton Bonds.
Yeah, the just like kind of schlocky stuff. But like, are they going to try and do the parodies of like the Craig espionage stuff now? Like, does that work? I don't know.
I would say more like Boston, more like a Mission Impossible, maybe more like I wouldn't say John Wick. That's not a good comp, but like stuff
Mission
like
Impossible,
that.
Mission Impossible,
yeah. Also, Mike Myers' face is kind of scary now.
A little bit,
but he only does movies in disguise. He'll never actually show his real face in a movie again.
Yeah, unless they make How to Marry an Axe Murderer sequel,
right?
Which I wouldn't. But yeah, I'd be interested. I liked all three Austin Powers. I know people were really down on the third one. I like all three of them. They still make me laugh to this day when I watch them. And then lastly, Sean Penn is going to direct Bradley Cooper in a movie about the early life of a January 6th policeman. One of the like the headline, you read it and you're just like, that's made up. That's made. There's just no fucking way. I'd say two things. The first being that Sean Penn, I don't think will ever stop being annoying. And he's just an annoying guy. It is what it is. He is who he is. He's going to be annoying forever. But what I would say is that I give him respect for at least being about what he says. Where like a lot of like, you know, Hollywood actors with like the whatever the cause du jour is, like that's the thing. Like they'll sit in the background and just complain and bitch and moan about stuff. Like Sean Penn's going to war zones. He's going to like disaster areas. He's doing the shit. So at least respect him on that level. But he's just annoying as shit. He's just annoying as shit, and this is an annoying ass movie, and I have zero interest in either elements of this.
But hooking up with Bradley Cooper, like, what a match made in heaven.
Bizarro. Like,
come on.
Cooper is a significantly, in every possible facet, a better director than Sean Penn. I would much rather Sean Penn be directed by Bradley Cooper.
It would make a lot more sense, right?
Correct.
Like, Sean Penn does look like the guy that would storm the Capitol. Like, he just does. He looks like one of those people. Bradley Cooper, no offense to those January 6th raiders, but...
But he's playing the cop, though, right?
Oh, he's playing the cop.
Is that what he said?
He's playing a cop, yeah. This is the early life of a cop.
Well, he's played a cop before. I guess Chris Kyle's not really a cop, but he's cop adjacent.
Yeah.
Maybe that works. I don't know.
Okay, so we're knocking Sean Penn's director. I want to push back a tiny bit here.
Into the Wild, great.
Oh, how about The Pledge?
I'm okay on The Pledge.
It's a good movie.
I'm not like
The Pledge.
But is that like hold a candle to anything?
Robin Wright Penn. It's an interesting movie about this cop that I don't want to give anything away. It's definitely worth a watch.
Does that hold a candle to like a Star Is
Born?
It's
about obsession, really. It's about like obsessing about something. Is that hold a candle to Star Is Born? No, but that's not fair. Like Penn, just because Bradley Cooper's great director doesn't mean that Penn is bad. Like I'd say Penn's a good director.
Who would you rather watch as a director? Would you rather watch
Bradley
like
Cooper.
Him the guy? Yeah.
But I'm saying it's closer than we're making it sound in the show.
I don't think it, did you watch like The Gunman or like any of this other more recent stuff?
He didn't direct The Gunman. He wrote The Gunman.
Are you sure he didn't direct The Gunman?
I'm looking at it right now.
Gunman
was directed.
He did that Ukraine
Gunman
movie
was directed
a few years
by Pierre Morel. So he didn't direct.
Who's didn't he do that Ukraine movie a few years ago, too?
He's done some stinkers of late.
Superpower?
Yeah. So that kind of hurts my argument, for sure. But I did rewatch The Pledge last year. The Crossing Guard's an interesting movie. Now, we're going way back, though, so maybe he lost that touch. That can happen. And I thought Into the Wild, better book than movie, but it's not badly directed.
I think it's a good movie.
I like the movie a lot.
Yeah.
The book's fantastic. So that's a tough.
I just think that if you give me two options, would you rather watch a documentary about January 6th, or would you rather watch a Sean Penn directed through his hyper political lens movie about the life, early life of a cop before January 6th?
Yeah,
like, what am I picking? I'm picking the documentary 100 times out of 100 every single time.
It's like COVID. I don't know if I need more of it.
It's just such a hot button issue, and it's like you're not going to. And
we're
just,
still talking about
it's
it.
It's just annoying. We've been talking about
it. No, it's just not timely. It's not timely. If this was like 3 years ago, it might be like, all right, but like, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, that's Sean.
It's an exhausting topic, but you're right. By an exhausting man, you're right about that.
It's exhausting. Yeah. That's the word for it. This is an exhausting headline.
Yes. Like, great call, Clemmer. So, what have you guys been watching? Physical media, anything like that? Anything to report?
I do. So Robbie Fox and I, we have a couple. Super Critics coming up, because I don't know if I'm going to be on this show again until after break. We have this right now. If you go and check, we have The Mask we did with Vibs. That was a good one. We have The Shadow coming up with Alec Baldwin playing a superhero. It's a bizarre movie from 1994. And then we have Blank Man, which is a Damon Wayans, like a Wayans David Alan Grier spoof on comic book movies. So we have both of those coming out in the next couple weeks. So if you're like interested, kind of like mid '90s, like what superhero movies were like, check out Super Critics on YouTube.
Hell yeah!
How about you, Gooch?
Like I said, Toy Story. a couple Toy Story rewatches, and then did some knocked out. 1.5 Spielbergs I hadn't seen.
I knocked out two. What did you knock out?
One was Duel, which I had to readjust my list. A little bit of a spoiler for what we're about to do.
Yep.
Had to readjust my list.
As you should have.
And then I got halfway through Munich last night before falling asleep. It was good. It was just very long.
Not my favorite movie. It's a brilliant movie. It's very underrated. Check out Munich.
Very. I agree.
Munich's brilliant. I checked. So from my point of view, I should mention, I did Ready Player One, which I liked the book a lot. Finally saw the movie. Did not like the movie. Except that Shining sequence is incredible. The rest of the movie stinks. And I saw Adventures of Tintin, which also kind of stinks.
Yeah.
I did not have to readjust my list.
I saw two Olivia Wilde movies. I saw The Invite, which I don't think I have full review on embargo yet, but like just to reiterate my social review on it, I loved it. I think it's some of the best laughs I've had in theaters in a long, long time. Very excited for that to go wide. And then I actually today went to I Want Your Sex, another Olivia Wilde movie, this time with Cooper Hoffman. The reviews of that, it's already out, from whenever it was at whatever last festival was.
Sundance, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess it's not under embargo, but I would just say very interesting in the main focus. Everything outside that, a little wonky and like some editing issues for sure. But other than that, enjoyed it for the most part.
I'm excited for The Invite.
Yeah, people.
I think you're going to love.
I'm really into that.
Rashida Jones, I can't believe that's Rashida Jones' script. That script is awesome. It is really so good. It is, and like they really trust the actors a ton, I think, to the point where like it feels like all these things, which are setups to great jokes, it feels like organic conversation. Like it feels like something like you would be saying to your wife. You know what I mean? Like it feels real.
Yeah.
So that part of it is really interesting. Okay, so that's what we've been watching. Now we can talk about do our Spielberg cumulative rankings, which I haven't seen yet.
Well, Ken Jack, before we do that.
Oh, no.
Before we do that, we have an interview.
We do have a pretty major interview. We do have a pretty major interview, so before we do that, let's hear from the star and director of The Death of Robin Hood, Hugh Jackman, and Michael Sarnowski. Hugh Jackman, Michael Sarnowski, here to talk about The Death of Robin Hood. An aged Robin Hood grapples with his past life of crime and murder while in the hands of a mysterious woman after being critically injured, coming into theaters June 19th. We saw it at decent while ago now, but anyway, it's one that really sticks with you. I think for you, Hugh, such a beautiful layered character. Reminds me a lot of Clint in Unforgiven. Like, what really brought you to the role?
That was one of the ones that was certainly in my mind when I read
it. Amazing.
Yeah, I love the script. It was unexpected. Obviously I've played Wolverine for a lot of years, so I'm used to working in that world of mythic sort of folk heroes, and I love the myth of Robin Hood. And when I read this, there was something about it. The word beautiful kept coming to mind. And this idea of the power of stories, the stories we tell ourselves, the stories we take in from when we're kids, how powerful, dangerous, or beautiful they can all be. You know, I just, everything about it was surprising. And I watched Pig, and I was 10 minutes into Pig, which is right.
Brilliant.
And I just texted my agent and said, I'm so in. It was very easy decision.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, beautiful is the word. Beautifully shot on film, beautiful costumes, beautiful locations. That production value is incredible. How important was it to you to get that specifically right?
Yeah, I mean, that was huge. That's why we decided on Northern Ireland, because we found a place that we could have, you know, beautiful coastal environments, these mountains, these forests, these old churches and castles. Like, all of that was within like an hour and a half of Belfast. And we shot this in 30 days, which is a pretty quick turnaround for a movie like this. And we needed to have sort of access to all those real places because we wanted to commit to shooting in real locations. Like, we didn't build that many sets. And that was, it was such like a part of the soul of the movie. Like, I think that natural environment kind of carries the brutality and carries that transcendent beauty of the story. And it just helped to like be in those places for the rough times when we were rolling around in mud. Well, you were rolling around in mud. I was just standing there. But, and then those moments when you needed to feel like connected to the world around you, like, it was not that it was easy, but it helped that sense of presence and place.
Mm-hmm. Rolling around in mud. Was that difficult for you, or was that the most difficult part of the shoot? What was the most difficult part of the shoot for you? Rolling around the mud?
I've never done an action sequence that hard.
Really?
Moment I was close to tapping out.
Really?
There was a period where I was like, don't talk to me. I was just sitting down and no one did. And I was getting a little testy.
There. No, Hugh's version of testy is not. It was just like, I just need to, like, my neck, I can't move my head. Give me a second. Like,
the mum was full on. It was a thing where the crew were walking. It was actually Ursula was walking and her boot just stayed in the mud. It was
just got stuck.
I'm still got mud in places. Like, I'm still fine.
So you obviously had an existing death tale of Robin Hood to work off of, but you also had to take some creative liberties here. And from what I've read, you're a big Robin Hood guy. So I'm kind of curious, like, how maybe cautious you were going into that, making your own liberties, your own additions, your own changes to something you have a lot of reverence for.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can't be too cautious about that. You have to find the character that you love in this. And I think we all have like a version of Robin Hood inside of us, of all these folkloric characters that we've kind of grown with. And it's a combination of different influences. And, you know, this was kind of based in my version and the things that it brought up for me. And then it just becomes a question of really interrogating those characters and figuring out where they want to go and how they want to interact. So, you know, I tried to use the old ballads and all of that as a kind of inspiration for the brutality and some of the themes that they were exploring. But I tried to like give myself the freedom to just kind of get to know these characters and see where they wanted to go.
Something I think was kind of challenging, I'm assuming for you as a writer and director, but also for you, Hugh, as an actor, is like they make a point right away to tell you, this is not a hero. This is not a good guy. And I kind of think as an actor, how hard is it to kind of build your empathy back with your audience? Because right away you're telling them, this is a bad guy, you should not like him, but now you kind of want the audience to come back around and be like a little bit like, I feel for this man.
Yeah, you know, it's weird. When I'm playing a character like that, I try to not go to, I want the audience to like him, I want the audience. I mean, I know I did because it's Robin Hood, but I thought the script was done so beautifully that actually if you feel his reluctance to be anything other than who he is at the beginning. He just wants out, like, I'm done. He doesn't want redemption. He's like, done. And then it sort of happens reluctantly and surprisingly. And then somehow to me, I find it incredibly moving because it's someone who has used story. He's a bad guy because he used story for his own purposes, selfishly, right? Told lies, told whatever. And in the end, I don't want to give away the ending, but he's finally doing something for someone else because he genuinely feels it. And somehow I think we're wired to forgive. Mm-hmm. We want people to be redeemed. We want that, I think, right?
What do you guys think? Yeah, most people.
Watching like the end of Star Wars and seeing Darth Vader all chewed up, be like, screw you, dude. Like, I hate you. Yeah.
So you said at the beginning, Robin Hood is a character. We like everyone knows Robin Hood. And you're honestly a person that I think like everyone knows. All audiences going to this movie, they already have a relationship to these characters, to you. Is that something, Michael, you're weaponizing at all, or is that something you're really trying to diffuse on set?
I would say, like, not quite either of those things. I think we were aware of it. Like, you know, early on, you know, we mentioned Logan as, like, okay, there's, like, this is a, you know, an aging man of violence. But it was almost in this exciting way of like, oh, but we're going to take this in such a different direction. And this yep. character is going to be so different that, you know, I think we went in with an awareness that people have certain connotations mm-hmm. With Hugh and with Robin Hood and all of these things. But we knew what we were doing and we knew what character we were trying to portray. So if anything, I think sometimes that can be a useful basis for entering the movie. But then it's like, you're going to go along for the ride and we're going to take you somewhere you don't really expect.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that the mythology of Robin Hood goes way back, around to 1100 somewhere, yeah. was with the first mention. And up until 1500 or 1600, he was just a bad guy. Mm-hmm. Universally hated, cautionary tale, don't be like him. And it switched just as there was the beginning of a sort of political change happening in England where all of a sudden people are starting to question the authority and royalty mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, this same mythology became this folk hero. Mm-hmm. And it's just this idea that we want our stories to reflect what we want them to reflect. We want our heroes to be what we need them to be. Mm-hmm. And be careful. Be careful of including ourselves. We want ourselves to tell a story of ourselves to everyone around us that suits us, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the great things about this, too, I think, is after release, when we watched it, you will go down rabbit holes of, like, reading yeah. more and more mythology about it. Same right. thing happened with, like, the Northman. Like, after watching Northman, like, I want to read now all this stuff about an epic saga. And now the same thing with Robin Hood. Because, like, I only knew very surface-level stuff about it. Like, I knew my girlfriend had a crush about him when he was a fox
for some reason. yeah.
I don't right. know why. Yeah. The fox version was the one that really struck a chord. Yeah. And I know that Kevin Costner, Cary Elwes to a degree, like, I knew all that. I didn't know any of the mythology behind it. This movie makes you really want to dig in deep into yeah. it, which yeah. I'm sure you did a lot of research on.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the fun thing is, like, there are all of these vastly different representations of Robin. Like, yes, we have our own very unique, specific representation of him, but, you know, it's just as different as, you know, animated fox to Kevin Costner. And all of these things are true in their own way, and they're all you know, Robin kind of belongs to all of us, and it's fun to get to explore that and to share our version with other people.
I read that this is your first time directing on film, 35mm.
Yeah.
How difficult or how different is that process versus digital as a director?
It wasn't really that different for me because I've worked with Pat Scola since Pig. He shoots all of my stuff, and we have a very specific way of working together. And I think weirdly, we've sort of always shot a little bit like how you would shoot on film. Like, we shot list everything very specifically. We don't do a lot of coverage. We don't do a lot of takes. Like, we kind of keep things sort of classic and simple. I think in a weird way for us, shooting on film just kind of brought everyone else on the same page as we've been on for a while. Like, it kind of gives this sort of focus and sacred element on set. And, like, I think Pat and I have always been kind of focused in that way, partially because of time. Like, Pig we shot in 20 days, Quiet Place was 40, this was 30. Like, there's always sort of...
Was 40?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I know, it's crazy.
Speaking of Clint, he would love this. Clint would have loved all this, yeah.
Right.
Right on time.
But, like, so I think in a weird way, film just kind of, like, suddenly everyone's like, oh, this is what we're doing. We're not doing, like, multi-cam setups and this. It's, like, it's sort of precious in a nice way. And it was nice to just feel like everyone was sort of in that same sacred space together.
Yeah, and you can feel it, too, at least when you watch it. It'd be very tactile. Like, you feel like you could almost feel like you feel like the dew on the castle, you know what I mean? And yeah. the film just captures that in a way that maybe digital just doesn't sometimes.
You do a great job of getting missed into your movies.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh,
your trademark.
It was a running joke on set. Like, there was never enough haze for me. I was like, they were like, really? You want that much haze for this? It's like, give me all the haze. I don't regret any of the haze.
Great call.
I love it.
The opening in that Glen, my goodness. Oh, I don't know how they were. No, this is amazing. But again, Death of Robin Hood, we do want to give you some rapid fire questions if that's okay with you. Starting with you, Hugh, there was some news that broke a few days ago about a certain pirate being flown around that you might be playing. What I have kind of an idea. So you like musicals.
Yep.
I love pirates. Right. Sea shanties are coming back around.
They are.
What about a play that involves sea shanties and pirates to put it on Broadway? Would you have any interest in that?
Sign me up.
Because we love sea shanties are really coming back into the mainstream.
They totally are. Yeah. My son was telling me that. He's been playing them for me. It's true.
I think that, I just want to put it out in the ether.
I'm serious. Are you joking?
I'm not joking whatsoever. Okay. I'm putting it out into the ether so that maybe it one day happens, which we have had success on before.
Hey, it happened with, who was it?
J. Jonah Jameson with J.K. Simmons. We did kind of make that happen again. When he came back, we made him read lines as J. Jonah Jameson in like 2016. And he then, like 2 years later, gets cast again.
I think it was like 20 days later.
Yeah,
so soon after.
So I'm just putting it out in the ether. Hugh Jackman led Sea Shanty musical on Broadway.
Sea Shanty Showman. I have fun saying that three times fast. Michael, as someone from Kentucky, I love seeing people from like non-traditional places break into the industry. But as someone from Milwaukee,
What would you say is like the most aggressively Wisconsin thing that you still love, you miss while you're away from home?
Custard. Yeah, I do love Cops Custard. That was when you were promoting Song Sung Blue, you were in Milwaukee and I was like, yeah, you got to go to Cops, and you were like way ahead of you. You had like bought a bunch of Cops for everyone. That and fried cheese curds. Those are the two like very Wisconsin.
Some Culver's, yeah.
Yeah, Cops if I can custard. Ever get some fried cheese curds, yeah. I'm just like, I'm there.
So obviously it's now one of the best movies of the year, at least in our opinion.
Yes.
But what we want to know is how good was the pitch for Sheep Detectives? Because when we try to explain it to people, we have difficulty. We're like, no, it's Talking Sheeps, but it's the best movie of the year. Like, you got to watch it. So how great was the pitch for you?
All I got was from Eric Fellner, who runs Working Title. He goes, this is the craziest thing you can ever hear. I'm going to send it, but it's Babe meets Knives Out. I'm like, all right. It was so nutty that I was like, I'm in. And then, and Craig Mazin. Mm-hmm. I'm like,
of course.
Oh. Well, Craig Mazin could be Sea Shanties and Cups Custard, and I'm in.
I mean, that sounds great. But
actually, there it is. But yeah, I'm thrilled you like that.
Such a blast. Absolute delight.
It really was.
Yeah.
I love, by the way, we were talking about Pig earlier. I loved reading about how you had been in YouTube rabbit holes, like truffle hunting, before you came to Pig.
Yeah.
Is there anything you're obsessing over right now, reading, watching YouTube videos that hasn't made it into one of your movies?
That's a good question, but I shouldn't say it because then I'll step on whatever movie. But what maybe. YouTube rabbit holes am I going down these days? I don't know. I've been a little too busy with this movie to go down any YouTube rabbit holes. I haven't been able to watch TV or anything lately. I don't know. Maybe I'll just make a movie about someone exhausted doing weeks of press. I love it. I love
anything
it.
You write, I'd watch.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. No. Another one I would love to ask you about is Death Stranding, because big Kojima fan here, and he's making, every time he does touches anything, at least in my opinion, absolute gold.
Yeah.
So Death Stranding around the corner. Is there anything that maybe, because you're doing obviously an original story, it's not just remaking whatever the story between the games, it's original. Is there anything that has been like a deal breaker for Kojima where he's like, I don't, do whatever you want, we need this?
Not really. He's been really generous with that, where like, I mean, he's happy to give ideas of like, oh, you could do like this character or like this creature, this all, like he has, you know, he knows this world incredibly well, so he's always ready to like give a crazy awesome suggestion. But he's been like, he's at the end of the day, he's always like, but this is your movie, like you are the director, it has to come from you and from your soul. And like, he's been so generous with that and so specific that like, you know, don't let me nudge you in one direction or another. If you want to come to me for ideas, I'm here. And he's been so generous with that. But no, I mean, it's been pretty amazing to like have such free reign in someone else's sort of masterful world.
I think you're probably going to end up being a custard salesman in Death Stranding 3. That's my guess. Mm. You're going to have been mocap doing just like how every
single... I just got to write this.
Just text it right down.
Man, I just want to be scanned.
Just scanned by Kojima.
Kojima's scan machine.
I so do not want to be scanned. That you know, sounds like a nightmare.
It just looks so funny when people are in that machine. I don't know why. And then finally, Hugh. Talked about Wolverine earlier. Talked about Logan. Obviously, you're still playing the character, but maybe one day, I don't know, you might live till 200 playing this character. But for the next actor who takes on the mantle, what's one thing you would hope they understand about the character that maybe is not obvious from the outside?
Huh. I don't know. I'm not going to say anything to whoever plays it, because no one said anything to me, which I really am thrilled about.
Okay.
And I had not read the comics, so I was just coming to it fresh. And I learned a lot over the years. Of course, I've got my own take, but it must be melding in with me in some way. So I hope someone just comes in and does whatever they want and makes it their own. And it's, well, I'm 57. I'm doing it till I'm 90. So,
of course,
you know.
I got some time. They haven't been born yet.
Yeah, I was going to say. I'll do a little time capsule for them.
Yeah. But again, Death of Robin Hood, we absolutely loved it.
Yes.
So much fun. Again, a beautiful, beautiful character. In a way, told in a way, again, if you're like us where you've watched very limited editions of him, you're going to see a whole new side of him for sure. And it's going to make you, if you're like me, go down Wikipedia and epic tale rabbit holes forever.
That's amazing.
Such a great time. Thank you guys so much for being with us.
Pleasure. Thank you to Hugh Jackman and Michael Cernowski, our two great friends. We went to the, or at least I went to the after party for Death of Robin Hood. Pretty sick. It was me and him standing next to like Bill Skarsgård, who brought in like this, like, it's like, you know how like Americans and New Yorkers dress, right? Like pretty regular, I would say, for the most part. Bill Skarsgård crew comes in. It literally looks like the crew from Zoolander. Like they all come into this like little bar, like Tavern on the Green or something. And it was just so funny. But yeah. And then we watched the Knicks come back and beat the Spurs together, all in this big bar, which is very cool. But yeah, shout out to, then go see The Death of Robin Hood 2, which is an awesome movie, which I believe me and Gooch saw. Did you see Clemmer with us?
No, I'm going to see it. We're taping this on, when are we taping this on? Is this a Wednesday? I've lost track of days with the travel and dust and stuff. I think I'm going to see it this weekend, hopefully soon. I got more travel ahead of me, but it's on my list. In fact, of everything that I haven't already seen this month, this is my the movie I'm most looking forward to seeing. It's coming out in June. Is that crazy?
I don't think so. If you liked Pig, which yes. I really love Pig, it's a return to like Michael Cernowski's like Pig.
All right. Let's
because
go.
You know what else he directed? He directed one of your least favorite movies, Cernowski, Clemmer. He directed Quiet Place Day One.
Oh, no. That stinks. That cat. That cat's ever. How'd the cat survive? That movie. You guys just interviewed him.
Watch Pig.
I'm excited for Death of Robin.
I'll say this much. If I could place the future on Cernowski right now and winning an Oscar, I would.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, me too.
Yeah. I think he's insanely talented and very smart. Like, very impressive.
Like, this is a great movie, and they shot it in, like, a month with, like, not a huge budget. So, like, think about it that way. Like, once he gets, like, I think the bigger call, like, from a studio, like, I think he'll deliver. At least I think so.
All right. But now into the Spielberg ranking. Spielberg mm-hmm. ranking. Where does Spielberg rank for you guys, by the way, all time, like as a director? If you had to, like, and maybe not exact ranking, but top 5, top 10, top 15.
It's hard because he defines like half of a century of Hollywood. You know what I mean? Like, he is the guy for 50 years of Hollywood.
Yeah.
So like, it's almost like you have to put him one, like, even if you don't love, like, I don't love his last.
I don't know about one.
No, but here's the thing. I don't love his last two decades of work, but for 30 years, he was the guy.
He was
like,
the king.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the longevity is there, but like, Scorsese's a better director than him. Like, Tarantino's a better director than him. Like, he's not in that camp for me. He's in like the next tier. He's directed, in my opinion, he's directed 10 great or very, he's directed 10 excellent movies. That's really good.
I mean, that's like all time is the thing.
He created the blockbuster. Like, that's like, I think that's pretty difficult to like, I don't know, underrate. Like, you have to give him the credit for that.
Oh, I know I do, but also, like, Tarantino's a better director than Steven Spielberg. I can say it my full chest. Martin Scorsese is a better director than Steven Spielberg. I believe that intrinsic to my core.
I don't know. Tarantino. I would push back on that because I think Spielberg's just more original and just actually has things to say, whereas Tarantino.
Scorsese, you going to push back on me?
No. Okay. I'd have Scorsese. Right. Okay. I would have Coppola above.
I did
Spielberg,
so
I even despite all the shit that, but Coppola just having The Godfather, having Godfather Part 2, having Apocalypse Now,
the conversation,
that's like, just that's unfair to like that's where the longevity, you got to give Spielberg a little bit of grace.
Yeah
he's a tough guy to pin down, I'll say that much. He's just like, for as many great movies as he's put out, he's also put out about 15 movies that I just do not care for.
You know who the actor comp for me for Spielberg is? It's Tom Cruise. Like, both, like, blockbusters, both, like, this incredible, like, just longevity. But, like, I don't think Tom Cruise is the greatest actor who ever lived. You know what I'm saying? But I love Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is a great actor. One of my favorite actors. But, like, I think that there's other actors. I think Robert De Niro is a better actor than Tom Cruise.
I think Tom Hanks might actually be a better comparison.
That might be the comparison.
Okay.
Hanks.
Yeah, because Tom Hanks, like, clearly has the chops to deliver multiple Oscar-worthy performances, but also has the capacity to make absolute fucking stinkers.
Like, I'm totally fine with that. Once again, my argument still stands where I think Robert De Niro is a better actor than Tom Hanks, but Tom Hanks is one of my favorite actors. Yeah.
But imagine if Tom Hanks had another decade and a half of dominance, which he doesn't. Like, for whatever he wants, his 80s is not his 90s. Like,
It's not.
Yeah. Like, Yeah.
And I still think Spielberg can ramp back up. The guy seems like he's like 60 years old. He
just
20.
Did Fablements, which is an excellent
movie.
That's
what I'm saying. Like, I think that he still has like a decade and a half left of him of like good to great movies.
I know about a decade and a half, but
he looks so young in all these interviews.
He's energetic. Like,
he wrote
Disclosure Day on an iPad.
I know, but
he's an iPad baby.
I think the 80s is when it's kind of a the 80s when things shift, unfortunately, for people, I think.
He made The Fablemans when he was only 75 years old.
Think he's going to make a movie when he's 95?
I don't know. Clint kept
right, thinking. And that's the exception to the rule. Like, people in their 90s, the quality of life is just, if you're blessed enough to make it that far, it's tough.
All right.
I hope I'm wrong. I hope he makes movies when he's 106. How's that sound?
I love that. There we go. All right, number 15. It's only one.
Are we doing top 10 list?
Oh, yeah, we do 10.
We do 10.
Wow.
Yeah. 10, and then we give the 15.
But we have the honorable mention at the end. But we do talk about
it. Yeah, we'll do the honorable.
Better for the graphic.
All right, number 10. And this snuck in because of my rewatch.
Oh, wow.
It's Duel. Duel's making the list at number 10 on all five lists.
Really?
So got that bonus. It is number 11 for me, number 12 for Clemmer. Or sorry, number 11 for Kinjek, number 12 for Clemmer, number 12 for me, number 12 for Kirk, and number 13. We're all very grouped together on that one. Kinjek, you have it the highest.
Yeah, I think it's such a, at least in my head, like such a just outside the top 10 Spielberg movie where it's like still early, doesn't have the maybe the money or the budget to like do the things maybe he thinks in his head, but still so good. Such a great like, I don't know how to say it, like prototype movie. Like when you watch like Spielberg, an older Spielberg movie now, it's almost like when you go and you go watch like Mean Streets for Scorsese or something. Or like when you go and watch an older movie from a director that is now acclaimed, like you see the roots of stuff forming earlier, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Can I give a shout out to something in New York? It's called the Film Forum.
Oh, great theater.
It's a great theater. Great, if you don't know New York or if you're just kind of visiting, they'll check out the Film Forum. Like, just like Google their website. They play a lot of classic movies. So like, the classic movies they play, I saw A Hard Day's Night there. I've seen Double Indemnity there. And it's just a really old theater. If you love movies, if you listen to this podcast, you obviously love movies. And if you're in New York, check out the Film Forum. And that's where I saw Duel. I saw it with one of our coworkers, Owen, one of our old coworkers. And I loved it. We had a great time together. We had a fantastic time watching it. Seeing it on the big screen, I don't know, I think it was a made-for-TV movie originally. So seeing it on the big screen with Owen, we both walked away with a real appreciation of it.
Yeah, it was an ABC movie of the week, which I can't imagine, like, that being you flip on like cable, one of your three television channels.
Your network TV,
you flip it on and you just get that. You get served up like an all-time Spielberg movie.
What a treat.
Yeah, no, I think I was blown away. I watched it, unfortunately, on my phone.
Oh.
Which is about the size of one of the screens at the Film Forum.
I thought you were going to say one of the size of the screens people watched in 1972.
Yeah, that too. But I was kind of blown away. Dennis Weaver, fantastic performance.
Oh, great performance.
And it kind of feels proto-Jaws in a way, like the way because it's a guy and he's basically just getting chased down by this just monster truck, this heaving, like, rickety old rusty oil tanker, I guess is what
it's a horror movie more than anything else.
Yeah, and yeah. He's just losing his fucking mind. It also feels a little bit like Beau's Afraid. Obviously a better movie in my opinion. But the guy's just paranoid as hell, seeing things that aren't there. I really, really, really liked it. Duel coming in at number 10. Love that snuck in. Next up we have Number nine. That's how these numbers work. Mm-hmm. Close Encounters. Mm. Close Encounters. Number 12 for Kinjek. Clemmer, not on your list.
Right.
Number 4 for me. Number 5 for Kirk. Number 5 for Jeff. I am the highest on this one. I did not see this until 5 years ago and immediately became a movie that I went back to time and time again. I think that it is just fucking brilliant. Like we were talking about with Disclosure Day, does not hold your hand at all.
Yeah,
at
that's
all.
Great.
But the questions it asks and the questions it leaves me with every single time just moves me. It moves me. Like that, just two people completely lost searching for something and just knowing more about Spielberg. And obviously you try to separate the art from the artist sometimes, but knowing that how it ties into Spielberg's childhood and just being a child of divorce, like that, it works for me. It really, really fucking works. And the score. Mm-hmm. John Williams, just brilliant.
Great companion piece, too, for E.T., I would say, where, like, it's just the opposite end of that spectrum, where it's like, oh, childlike wonder and delight. And then it's like, oh, this is a little bit on the other end of that, for sure. But, yeah, I would agree with you on that. No, I'm definitely, obviously, not as high as you, but it's a movie I really like.
Also, Dreyfuss. I love Richard Dreyfuss. I just love him.
Yeah.
Not on my list.
Yeah, not on your list. What doesn't work for you?
So I've watched this movie three times. I've tried three times to connect this movie, and for whatever reason, I can't connect to it. I completely understand this is a blind spot for me. Most people who watch this movie enjoy this movie, love this movie. People I respect enjoy and love this movie. For whatever reason, I am just not on the same wavelength as this movie, which is crazy because for almost all of Spielberg's movies, I feel like that's what he's so great at, is getting you to connect these characters. And that's the whole thing. That's what was I think Spielberg's greatest strength. And really, one of the weaknesses of Ready Player One, for instance, where that's like the least charismatic, likable cast he's ever had. And it's a big reason why it doesn't work. And it's so unlike Spielberg. And I'm not saying Dreyfuss isn't charismatic, because he is. But I couldn't connect to it. And I don't know why. And it's a me thing.
Yeah.
So you guys can have it as high as you want. I'm not going to argue with you, because I now understand, after living on this earth for 46 years and seeing people's appreciation for this movie, that I'm the outsider here. So, I'm not going to argue with you guys.
I would say, though, it's out of his classics, it is the one that I would say, like, the general public has least seen or least talks about. Like, so
if I was going to recommend a Spielberg movie to someone, this would be among the lower of his good movies, for sure.
Yeah, it's not like, I don't think it's an entry point.
This was highly touted in the 80s, though. So in the 80s, growing up, like, this was kind of a point of reference of, like, oh my God, this guy did Jaws, E.T., and Close Encounters. Like, this was a movie that was very, very well respected. I think the reason people haven't seen now is just so old.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Still holds up. Do, do, do. Do, do, do. That's my impression of John Williams' score, or the aliens visiting. What do you think they'd
play
now?
Better score would have been a bang, too.
Here's my Bill Simmons impression. What do you think they'd play now?
And do you think of that movie probably do better with a better John Williams score? Because among all the movies he did in that period with Spielberg, that's probably the weakest of his scores.
Well, that's in the middle of that run, isn't it? It's right in between Jaws and then Raiders.
Jaws,
right?
Raiders, fucking Star Wars happening right before that, and like all these other great, iconic, fantastic, amazing, like you cannot mistake it for anything else scores, and then it's just Close Encounters, which is just whatever it is. Like,
not to get sidetracked, we didn't really talk about the score in Disclosure Day. What'd you guys think of that? You don't really
not a huge
get,
character.
You don't really get that kind of score anymore. Like the melody.
I wouldn't say I would agree with you. Like, you feel him, Williams, anyway, but like I don't feel like I felt him in the way that you would usually feel him in a Silver joint.
I thought it was kind of weak and not. At times, it felt goofier than the action on the screen was portraying. Like, it was lighter. Maybe that's a better word. It was lighter than the action on screen was portraying, and it's very unlike Williams Spielberg collaboration, where I felt like for the first time ever, they weren't exactly on the same page.
But like we said, I don't know if Spielberg was on the same page with himself.
That's a very fair take.
Yep.
Next up is, like you said, the companion piece. At number 8, E.T.
Oh, wow.
Tinjack, you have it 7. Eight. Klimmer, you have it 3. I have it 14.
14?
Kirk has it 2. Yes, I have the same problem. I have the same problem you have with Close Encounters. I have that problem with E.T. I recognize all the great movie making, the movie magic going on. I cannot connect with that fucking alien.
Wait, did Jeff have it?
Or that kid. Jeff does not have it on the list. And I'm wondering if he just
that's
fucking
wrong.
Forgot.
That's absolutely wrong.
How do you forget
he
E.T.?
Fucked that up.
He doesn't have it.
That's like that's like one of his number one all-time movies. He fucked that up.
Okay.
Like, he absolutely fucked that up.
Well, he fucked this list. E.T.
So then E.T. would have been higher then.
That alien's going
to be. It would have definitely been higher. That's like, whenever he talks about movies, that's like one of his number one all-timers.
I guess that makes me feel a little better, because E.T. So E.T. is the first movie I ever saw in theaters. Now, back then, movies would stay in theaters literally for a year, especially a blockbuster like this, literally for a year. So I saw it at the tail end of its run. It came out when I was 2, but I saw it when I was 3, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
The magic hit me then. I still have very, obviously I was 3, so small, but going to movies is such a big deal. So I have tiny memories of like my mom crying when E.T. turned gray.
He's dying.
It was
he's
very,
sick.
Yeah, I remember thinking, oh, this is so sad. My mom's crying. And I remember thinking that. But I've seen the movie now, I don't know, Christ. I don't know, probably over a dozen times. It's just been in my childhood forever, probably more than that. This movie's great, man. I think it holds up really well. I think the family dynamics work really well. It's just such a relatable movie. I'm shocked you don't connect to it.
Yeah, I think it's just the design, to be honest. Like, something about him, just like, I don't feel for him. And the kids too, also. Maybe it's a generational thing, I don't know. But you guys love it too, so generational.
I have it at 7, but like I would be more on your side here than I would be on Klemmer's. Like, to me, I don't have a personal resonance with it. I just respect it as a movie, like in the sort of like innovation, I would say, that goes with it, and sort of like all the iconic moments formed from it. And like, whether it's, you know, Crossing the Moon, the fucking Reese's Pieces, the score, like even like bringing like Drew Barrymore. It's like there's so many elements of it that make an iconic movie. But like, I don't have a humongous personal connection to it, but I recognize it as an iconic piece of filmmaking.
Oh, I had like an E.T. plush doll that I used to carry around with me. Like, yeah, I E.T. horrifying. Was. No, but he, like, it's funny you guys say that, because, like, in my mind, he's just not. Like, in my mind, he's, like, that's, like, loving. Like, I know he's, like, I understand he's odd looking. I'm not, like, that, like, blind to it. But when he was, like, one of the first figures. Remember, this came out when I was 2 and 3. Like, this is my childhood, is E.T.'s, like, weird little body. And, like, so I don't see it as anything. Whoa. As anything but, I know, but, like, that's, you guys love fucking Shrek. Shrek to me sucks. Like, fuck Shrek.
Shrek is 500 times better than E.T.
No.
Like, as a character.
Fuck
as a character.
Fuck you.
As a character.
You. That's, no, not as a character. As anything, he's not. That to me is like, that's like a war crime, what you just said. Like,
nuh-uh. That's crazy. If you opened your heart to the mysteries.
If you opened your heart, E.T. is so loving.
You also, and let's be very clear for our listeners, you despise fantasy. You hate fantasy. And
hate
Shrek
fantasy.
Is all fantasy.
Fuck
and Shrek is all fantasy. So that's
love,
a big part
I love
of
E.T. But I think a lot of his generation, like I said, like growing up with E.T. being everywhere. Now, if I grew up when you guys did, I probably would like think, like, oh, E.T.'s kind of this weird looking creature. I imagine I feel that way.
I don't know if it's the
big
same
turd.
For you, Ken Jack, though. E.T. was still massive when I was a kid.
No, 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 still, no, 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 no. I'll throw the flag on that one. E.T. in 1983 compared to E.T. in whatever, 2002? No.
I'm old.
Not even comparable. How old are you? How old when you were
born in 94. So.
Right. So, I'm sorry, 1999 then. E.T. in 80, when the movie fucking came out?
I don't know. I
mean, come on. That's just insanity.
I can just remember it always. I can remember it.
It was very
being
pervasive.
Just, of course it was, but it's not like when it came out.
I can be.
But, I'm trying to think of a way to compare
it. I just remember
the way
renting it and seeing it so many times as a child.
It was the biggest movie in the world, literally.
I remember thinking it was the coolest thing ever, though, on Halloween.
I don't agree with
when he sees like the Star Wars characters. I was like, oh, that's cool. It's like a nice little Easter
egg. I lived it. I can tell you it's not. I mean, don't get me wrong. E.T. is iconic. Even to this day, you show someone a picture of E.T., they're going to know it's E.T. I'm not saying that, but when it came out, it was the biggest movie of all time.
Yeah. I think I would agree with more on your side, Clemmer, in that obviously we were important then, but like also like it was so pervasive in every element of our upbringing. We're like, think about it this way: every cartoon you watched, every show we watched, anything that you had growing up would have like an ET episode. Everything that you did would involve ET in some sense, and you go, oh, that was the OT, they're doing ET here. Like, yeah. Everything had ET involvement in some way, shape, or form, because they all wanted to try to recapture that same level of magic, which I think goes to show you how important and big of a movie that is, which to whatever, yeah, to, I mean, I guess, to Gucci's point,
iconic. Number 7, talked about it earlier. Catch Me If You Can.
Oh, I love this movie.
Number 9 for Ken Jack. Number 5 for Clemmer. Number 5 for me. Number 8 for Kirk. And number 11 for Jeff. Terrible take, Jeff. Yeah, no, I fucking love this movie. And I thought it was like considered lowbrow. At least I thought the public perception of it was like, this is lesser Spielberg because it's 21st century Spielberg. Until recently, and you just talk to people, and I think everyone agrees this movie is just a great fucking time. Just great. Just globetrotting. Leo's doing just an unbelievable performance. Tom Hanks is at the top of his game.
Still haven't said that's the performance.
You think that's the performance? I know that that's the one that got nominated.
Correct.
In this movie. And I, yeah. Leo did not, right?
I
which
believe
I think
he did
is
not.
Fucking crazy.
Crazy. But that, you know how it is. The Academy makes the young actors earn their stripes. They just do. It's not fair.
Yeah.
This is what it is. Christopher Walken in this movie is so heartbreaking. It's such
so
a
good.
It might be like one of like the best. Not obviously it's Spielberg, so there's a ton of great movies to pick from, but it's one of the better Spielberg directed performances. I just think the world of this movie. I love the way this movie looks. I love the way this movie sounds. It's just top to bottom. This is Spielberg at his absolute peak, and just delivering.
Yeah, maybe his sexiest movie too, which he doesn't do a lot of, but like it's got a little sex appeal. Like Leo really is just kind of just the fucking man. Like he's so
looks
fucking
great.
Cool.
He's doing like a proto version of his Wolf of Wall Street, like Jordan Belfort, I guess, like con man guy. And I just think it looks so great. The cat and mouse element all across the globe, like you're saying, is just so fantastic. And like a lot of people with Disclosure Day coming out have been posting like clips of like some of Spielberg's best blocking, camera movements, and all that stuff. The one that they posted recently, I'm sure you've seen it, Gooch, where it's like they're following like the guns of the agents as they scour his house. Like it's just so good. Just absolute fucking nails across the board. Great, great movie.
Can we talk about Leo's career for a second leading up to this movie? I just want to explain, especially people maybe who are younger. Mm-hmm. So he does Titanic in 97, right? Becomes a giant star. We all know that. Okay, so then he follows it up with a movie called Man in the Iron Mask, which he had done before Titanic, and then a small part in a Woody Allen movie. It doesn't really, so neither of those count, okay? 2000, he has a movie called The Beach. Which is directed by, Danny Boyle. and it doesn't work. It bombs, right? And Leo is kind of like, it's 2002 now, okay? So he has done one movie, one real movie since Titanic, and it bombed. Two movies come out, I want to say, like the same month. Gangs of New York comes out December 20th, 2022. Catch Me If You Can comes out December 25th. They are a week apart. These movies both come out, and then Leo's off the races. But before this, and before Gangs, before this week in 2002, excuse me, we didn't really know who Leo was yet. We knew Titanic Leo, but we hadn't really seen it. And so you got to understand, when you went and sat down and saw this movie in 2002, Leo's magic wasn't quite there yet, and you saw it here, and then it was off the races. This is maybe his most...
like not important, but like it's sustaining role.
I see what you're trying to say.
It's sustaining.
It's the moment where I think he figured out who he was as an actor. Like where we figured out who he was as an actor.
Yes. And then remember too, you could have saw this and then saw Gangs of New York the next day, and you're seeing like, and you're like, oh shit, this guy's for real. Because we didn't know
Spielberg
he was for real.
Him and Spielberg and Scorsese movies in the same week. Like how crazy is that?
I know. What a treat, right? The only reason I remember that, because I distinctly remember going to see these two movies that in that same month and being blown away by both and thinking like, this guy has the goods.
God damn, Frank Abagnale still alive.
Yes.
Yeah, they did say like half of his story was a lie. I think they announced kind of recently, but it doesn't matter to me. Movie's
kind of fun though. Like that's kind of fun. That's fits.
This movie's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could have honestly. Nah, I can't go higher than five. Can't go higher than
five. I can't go higher than five. I tried to. Because I love this movie so much.
I really like it. Number six, this is lower than I would have had it. Jurassic Park.
What?
Six for Kinjo.
Six? Wow.
Two for Clemmer, two for me.
I thought it'd be hard.
14 for Kirk. And seven for Jeff.
Oh, yeah. I actually talked to Kirk about this. He doesn't love Jurassic Park. I don't understand, because I think Jurassic Park is one of the great science fiction movies of all time. This idea was so good. They had a Good Morning America piece on it like the next week, saying like dinosaurs could be real. They had scientists on to talk about it. Like that's how much this movie was gigantic. Comes out in that summer. I remember it was in theaters just forever. This movie is so good. It's the Jeff Goldblum performance. You're on the edge of your seat. It ages so well, and they keep trying to capture the magic in these sequels, and nothing can. This movie is awesome.
Yeah, this is the movie that was everywhere when I was a child. Like when I was
big
4
time.
Years old. Obviously, this comes out the year I was born. But Jurassic Park 2 and Jurassic Park 3, it stayed in the... I mean, it just kept going and going. But people were obsessed with the franchise. And so was I. Like, I was obsessed with dinosaurs. Every kid for a decade, two decades, was obsessed with dinosaurs. And they still are. Like, were kids really that obsessed with dinosaurs before this movie?
Yeah, they were.
Like this, though?
I mean, the only thing new was raptors. We didn't know what raptors were.
Oh, man, I was...
So, like, but, like, every kid had, like, rhinoceros, whatever the fuck it is, Tyrannosaurus Rex. They had all those characters. Brontosaurus. We kids still love dinosaurs.
The first, raptors, let me put this way. The first long word I ever knew how to spell was in kindergarten. It was paleontologist.
Oh?
Because that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be Sam Neill. Like, that's was the dream, to go dig up dinosaur bones. And... they can bring them back now. I don't know if dinosaurs can come back because they can't live in this atmosphere, but they have figured out how to bring animals back, right?
I don't
like
know.
With the, like basically the same concept of like science genes. No, this movie, I think it works on like every single level. It works on the sci-fi elements. It works on the horror elements, just the spectacle. I think out of any scene, even more than Jaws, which we'll get to in a minute, Raiders, I think the best scene in all of Spielberg's filmography is the scene when they sit down on that hill and they move in herds. They do move in herds like that. The score, just the blocking,
it chills,
the CGI that still holds up. Like it just all comes together and makes just a perfect moment. Like it's a perfect movie moment.
It's a fascinating movie. I think it's a great episode of Movies That Made Us too. If you ever watched that on Netflix, like all the behind the scenes of how they did that with CG. Like they initially just wanted to do it all with props and all with like animatronics and puppets and shit like that. And they tried it and it just looked super fucking fake, which it just does. And then they really, I think the guy that they had do it, it's really funny, the guy that did the initial designs on the CGI for the dinosaur, like they did it very last second. They figured out how to do it. And they're like, oh, okay, let's just try that. And it turned out to be the biggest phenomenon of like the entire decade. So good. Like you mentioned, some of the best iconic scenes when they turns Laura Dern's head to go look at them. It just looks good. Like it looks like a real theme park. Like so much investment put into that element of it, which I think works really well. And the soundtrack, one of the best of John Williams, in my opinion. Like, I absolutely, if you're talking some of the best scores and best themes of any movie in history, like, it's up there. And just a great adaptation, too. I never read the book, but everyone I've ever heard talk about the, was it Michael Crichton? Michael Crichton book. I've never heard about it. It's like, oh, the movie's way better. But I don't know if that's true.
I've heard the book is amazing, too, for what it's worth. But I've never read it.
This is the first time CGI was really, like, in, like, it, people walked out of the theaters because they didn't know what CGI really was, thinking dinosaurs were real.
Yeah.
I mean,
they're like, did Spielberg somehow pull this off? That was a real conversation people had in 1983. And that's just to show you how good it looks. Yeah, I mean, this movie, this is everything. I can't wait to show my son this one day.
Yeah, that's the incredible. Other thing. Like, I know it will play. Like, it'll play till the end of time. I know you haven't watched the show, Clemmer, but the Ted series does have a funny bit on what you just said. Like, it's like set in the 90s, and they go see the movie, and then afterwards they're like, no, he made Jaws, he made E.T., and they let him have dinosaurs. Those are real dinosaurs, and they're like in the car being like, no, they're real. They're real.
That was a real conversation people had, for real.
So great.
So good.
Number 5, The Last Crusade. Ken Jack, you have it 4. Clemmer, 7. Me, 6. Kirk, 3. Jeff, 8.
I fucking love The Last Crusade so much, man. Everything about it, like, you get the what you love out of it, which is killing Nazis. Always great. Yeah. I think you get some of the best. It's Sean Connery supporting performance, and this is so good. You get such great comedic beats throughout it. Man, just, and I think the ending is so strong when they're in like that temple in whatever is in Syria. It's so cool with the fucking guy with the he chose poorly. Him just like, with that theme playing as he walks away. The big chase scene in Venice. The rats in the sewers. Like, there's so many fantastic moments in this movie. Even like in the escape from the castle. Like, such great like little comedic timing moments. The fucking chase on the motorbikes afterwards. Like, there's so many great points in this movie. Like, I'm gonna rewatch it when I get home. Like, I'm gonna rewatch it now when I get home. It's so fucking good. And an inspired pick, by the way, getting both Sean Connery and Wright River Phoenix. As young Indy, so good, and just a beautiful movie, man. Gorgeous to look at. I gotta rewatch it.
What number do we have this at in the list?
It's a number 5.
So this is my favorite Indiana Jones movie. Like, I like this more than Raiders.
Me too.
I just love this movie. I love the humor that Connery brings, the gravitas that he brings too. Like, only he could be. It's hard to be a Harrison Ford's dad, especially Indiana Jones's dad. But like, Sean Connery, that makes sense. This is my favorite of the Indiana Jones movies, so I'm happy it made it this high on the list. I'm guessing there'll be one higher, but
it's my favorite. It's hard for me to say it is. Raiders isn't better, but like, I'm picking like, which one do I personally like more?
Yes.
Like which one do I have more of an affection in my heart for? It's Crusade, but I think the which one's better is probably Raiders.
So this came out the same summer 89, same summer as Batman. And Ghostbusters 2 came out that summer. It was kind of this weird summer of sequels and remakes, if you want to call Batman that, of sorts, or at least IP. But I remember that summer going to see Glass Crusade, going to see Batman. Like, just summer of 89 is a big summer in movies.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of blockbusters. Great shot.
He's holding he rips away that cross or whatever, and like, you get like the punch or something, and then it comes back too, and he's like in the future on the boat or whatever, getting interrogated by the guy in the white that now has that same. Just so many great moments in this movie, man.
It's a good one.
I mean, I gotta remember what is the line he says when Indy is like interrogating his father, but like,
oh, she talks in her sleep.
She talks.
Oh yeah,
there it is. She talks in her sleep. Oh my god. Yeah, no, he's great in that movie. Fuck.
So good.
So fucking good. Next up, Saving Private Ryan. Ken Jack, you have it 3. It's one of your all-time faves. I know that. Clemmer, 8. Me, 7. Kirk, 9. Jeff, 3 as well.
Yeah, it's one of the best war movies ever made. I think if you're looking for a movie that really throws you into what feels like a real conflict, like, that's it. Like, the production value on it, off the fucking charts, top to bottom, from like, you know, being in like recreating D-Day to also just like the actual like uniforms they're wearing and the guns, like, all that shit is crazy well done. And then you just get like an actually really, really great performance out of not only obviously Hanks, but all the side cast, like Burns, Vin Diesel, like Adam Goldberg, like all these other guys, like we talked about this kind of recently, but Tom Sizemore is like unbelievable in
it. Really good in the movie.
Really, really good. Jeremy Davies is amazing in it.
Incredible.
Like, so, so good. And then Matt Damon just out of nowhere, like not really out of, not super out of nowhere, but like he comes on super late, which I just saw an interview where he said like the only reason he got that is because Robin Williams introduced him to Spielberg. Like he sent in self-tape, they didn't respond. And then Robin Williams like brought him to dinner with Steven Spielberg. And Spielberg's like, you're in.
And I don't believe he was in the marketing. So like when you went and saw it in the theaters, you were surprised it was him. I want to say he wasn't credited either, or like or late credit or something. I want to say when people first saw the movie, they were surprised it was Matt Damon. Like they didn't know who Ryan was.
And he's really good. And he delivers that one off-script sort of ad-libbed monologue where he talks about him and his brothers and stuff, which is unfucking believable. And it hits your heartstrings. And then obviously Tom Hanks is just amazing. So I think everything talked about it. And also like the ebbs and flows of this movie, it is so sharp, like so fucking tight. Like there is not like a second you could shave off of this. It's I love it. Really, really love this movie.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. It's just I'm not a war movie guy. Like that's just what it really comes down to and why it's not top five for me versus top 10. But I think it's, like you said, the production value, incredible. The performance is incredible. I think it's unbelievable. It's just, do I love war movies? Not particularly. But this is, if I had to pick like the greatest of like the past 30 years, this is probably it.
There's two takeaways for this movie for me. One is the D-Day scene up top. It's one of the great openings in movie history, I think. It's just, it's harrowing.
I mean, it's visceral. Like it's, people, it's so good. The reports that you read of like people like not being able to sit in that theater.
They had to leave.
Oh yeah, no, yeah, yeah. Real war veterans who had to live through it had to leave. It was that it felt that real to them, which I can imagine the trauma there. And also, it just shows you the bravery of those soldiers. Like what it showing it like that, that having that real just gives you so much more respect for World War II veterans and what they went through. Jeremy Davies being a profile in cowardice. You don't usually see cowardice in war movies. It's like everyone's a hero, which most military people, you know, anyone who signs up, you're doing something I would never do, so God bless. But I love that it did show this character. And honestly, like, who's to say I wouldn't be the Jeremy Davies character? Who's to say and none of us would be? How do you know how you would react in that situation? And almost like because of that, I can't really judge Jeremy Davies' character because I've never been in that situation. I don't know. Would I be a hero? Would I step up or would I be a coward? And I don't know. Thank God I've never been in that situation. So I really appreciate that Spielberg had that character on screen, which you want to hate initially. But because Spielberg movies have such depth in them and such intelligence, and like you guys said earlier, don't hold your hand. It allows you to think about it.
Yeah. And also I would note another scene that I think really stuck with me, especially watched it way too young. But Giovanni Ribisi's death in that is so fucking brutal. And so well acted across from everybody, not just him, but everybody's so good in that scene. Holy shit, it's good. Really, really good movie.
All-time Rob at the Oscars, by the way. That was like maybe Weinstein's masterpiece.
Obviously, we're talking about Shakespeare and Love winning. Harvey Weinstein, famously. I mean, there's a great book, Oscar Wars. Read that if you love movies.
You got like the one vet in America that like didn't like the movie, right? To like basically like go to newspapers and
it's a wild the level also like manipulated or kind of held people's jobs over their head, like if you don't vote for this, if I find out, you know, I'm not going to cast you in movies, like a wild, right? And it worked. Shakespeare in Love won Best Picture.
Crazy. Disgrace, absolute disgrace.
Next up we have Schindler's List.
Kenjack, so this is number what?
Number three
is Schindler's List. Okay,
top three. Schindler's List, Ken Jack, you have 5, Clemmer 4, me 8, Kirk 6, Jeff 4. Who's the highest?
Yeah,
there?
Just
Clemmer. You have
very
the
hard movie to rewatch. I would say for sure, right? But like not one you ever want to ever have to see again. But like expertly done across the board. And
yeah, just brilliant. Tells a complicated story too, and does it in a way where it's like really easily understood. Like, you know, like it's think about this movie. It's historical fiction in black and white telling a incredibly sad story, and yet you know, people went out in droves to see it, and it was the talk of the country when it came out. Like, that's hard to do, and he pulled it off.
I mean, just the bold filmmaking choice of setting it black and white is just insane, just crazy. And to pull it off, I also think it's the best acted of his movies. Like
Ralph Fiennes.
Top to bottom. Ralph Fiennes, Liam Neeson, Ben Kingsley.
Ralph Fiennes in this movie. And obviously we later found out how talented Ralph Fiennes was, but we didn't know at the time when this movie came out kind of who he was. And this is one thing we haven't mentioned about Spielberg. How good is this guy at casting his movies, right?
Really.
Like,
really
to go and cast. Liam Neeson also, he wasn't really a name yet. Like he had been in stuff. Like you had seen him as kind of a character actor in stuff. But he wasn't yet the guy yet. And then also kind of bring in Ben Kingsley. Like, Ben Kingsley hadn't done shit for a while. Like, he obviously won an Oscar for Gandhi, but he hadn't really worked very much in the years. Or, you know, wasn't doing great projects. Brings them all together for this masterpiece. Spielberg's an amazing amazing director when it comes to just acting. And I think you're right, Gooch. Is this his best acted movie?
I could see the case limited. For... We're going to get to another movie in a second. I could see the case for the one at the top, but...
But like, I think what helps it here too is there's such like a limited scope, like as far as like how many people are getting a ton of lines. It's really just a lot of Liam Neeson. It's a lot of Ralph Fiennes and a lot of, I guess, Kingsley as well. But like every other movies, there's like a lot more mouths to feed, I would say. So maybe this one, like that consolidation helps a lot.
Yeah. And also just it's his most dramatic, like just pure drama, like straightforward.
Yeah. It's kind of incredible that he... I feel like Steven Spielberg has, and maybe I'm wrong, if I am, correct me, guys, but like, has directed really the two most, like, go-to movies, iconic movies of World War II, right? Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan. Yeah. I feel like those are the two movies that people would mention first. Those movies are both now 30 years old. He was not alive during war, or what was he? Like, or barely, right? How old was he when World War II was happening?
That's a good question.
What year? How old was Spielberg?
Was Spielberg?
If he was, he was a baby, alive. Right?
Yeah, 46, so a year after.
So he's right. So he's born after the war, right? Of course, right? Because he's a post-war baby that is able to connect to an event that happened before he was born and make the two. And I gotta think, 50 years from now, maybe I'm wrong. Those are gonna be the two movies people think of. Oh yeah, World War II. You gotta see those two movies.
Yeah, I'd agree. I don't think those are going anywhere.
That's an impressive
achievement. They're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Number two, Raiders. Raiders of the Lost Ark. Ken Jack, you have a 2. I have it 3. Klimmer, you have it 9. Kirk 2. Or Kirk 4. Jeff 2. This is maybe top 10, top 5 most rewatched movie of my lifetime. If I just need to get in a good mood, want to throw something on, this is the movie. I think Harrison Ford is just like Indiana Jones, obviously. Indy is just like the coolest fuck. Like when I first saw that as a kid, I was like, that guy. That guy's so
guy alive.
Fucking cool. He's a fucking archaeologist. He's a historian. He's the hottest fucks? Man alive. His students are trying to fuck him with their eyelids, closing their eyes. Call me, kiss me. What was it?
I think he said, I love you or something.
I love you. That's what it is. I mean, just everything about him is the coolest. And it's just, it's got that old school movie magic where it's like the big sets and the big, like the way they show the plane flying from nation to nation. It was the first time I'd ever been exposed to anything like that like Powell and Pressburger filmmaking. And it just looks, it's just timeless. I love it. And the score is amazing. It's just so cool.
I have it 9th, but it's only because the stuff I have in front of it are all, in my opinion, great movies. I mean, I guess in the one movie we're not going to touch on here, we'll touch on it later, is like Munich, but like, that's something I just really appreciate. But like, other than that, everything else is on this list. And it's like, all right, where do I find place for it? I don't know. I have it 9th only because I just like Last Crusade a little more. So I have that 7. I don't know, man. You could put this, you know, if someone said this was number one, I'm not going to argue with you. These are all, now we're just saying like, who's better, Joe DiMaggio or Willie Mays? Like, I don't know what to say. Yeah. This is greatness.
Well,
yeah. You know what scene I forgot, by the way, from Crusade that I almost forgot about was that, do you remember when like they get captured by the Nazis and they're like, like, we're going to go catch Brody. And they're like, you'll never catch Brody. He speaks 18 languages. He'll blend in, disappear. You'll never find him again. It just cuts to him in Cairo just walking around. And he's like, does any of you speak English, please? Yeah. And like, it's so good. But yeah, Raiders, I mean, it's one of the most like instantly magnetic movies ever. Like, even doesn't matter if you're a kid, adult watching it. Like, it is so instant. Like, they get you right into the action. You get it right away and you're in. Like, that opening scene, the like swap of the thing with Alfred Molina, so good. He's running down the fucking, like, every scene. Think about it. The first, like, 20 minutes of that movie is nothing but iconic scenes. Like, scenes that get replicated time and time again in other movies. And then it just goes on further you go into it. And great ending. The great villains in the Nazi duo, but specifically, obviously, the glasses guy with his fucking burnt up hand. Yeah. Karen Allen. I mean,
Karen Allen is so good in this.
She did something to my brain chemistry as a child. Dude. Oh, like, that raspy voice.
All of us.
Like, her drinking at the table. Oh my God.
Drinking them under the table, literally.
Yes.
Oh, it's so fucking good. Another Crusade thing I almost forgot. The fight on the plane where they, or is that in this one? The fight in the plane is this one. Yeah, because Karen Allen comes up into the plane. Yeah. So the fight in the plane, great fight. I think the shots you get of the desert when they're like digging into the tomb or whatever, So fucking, just a beautiful movie top to bottom. Gorgeous, well acted. And again, another iconic scene, shooting the guy with the gun when he pulls out the sword. There's just so many great moments, whether spontaneous or scripted by Spielberg, that are, they're just etched into movie history for me. And just, they created one of the coolest, him and Lucas created one of the coolest movie characters in history. Like, just seemingly out of thin air. That, like, every single movie, it feels like so many movies that we watch chase making that character and nobody can achieve it. Like, nobody can ever get anything even as a shadow of Indiana Jones. And that's how great that character is.
I still think it's crazy, looking back, too, that he didn't want Harrison Ford. Like, he just...
Tom Selleck.
He wanted Tom Selleck. Which, honestly, might have worked. Probably would have really worked, but I'm glad we got Harrison.
Yeah. Me too.
Because now, yeah. I mean, I can't believe he has all those characters under his belt. That's just insane. Also, I would recommend to anyone, if you're a Soderbergh fan, Soderbergh has a black and white cut that with the Reznor and Ross Social Network score reworked behind it, and it's really fucking cool. I'd recommend watching that if you're a fan of Raiders and Soderbergh. Really cool. And then number one, it's the most unanimous number one I think we've ever had since we've done the list. Every single person on the panel has it at one. It's Jaws. Big surprise. I mean, might be the best movie of all time. It's not my number one, but it's top five. It's perfect. There's nothing. Yeah. This is the one that I also think has a case as best acted. Roy Scheider, yes. Just unbelievable. Unbelievable in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect movie. There's not a single scene, frame, line, second you cut out of this movie. It's brilliantly made. The characters are iconic. It all kind of even ages really well with the idea of, like, politicians will do anything to get more money, like the mayor just, you know, willing to keep the beaches open. Like, it's all believable in 2026, like it was believable in 1975. It looks fantastic. It's the suspense, like you can see, like, the Hitchcock feel to it, the vibe to it, and then he elevates it. The stuff with, like, the close-up of Scheider on the beach, it's all just brilliant. It's incredible. It's a work of art. It's maybe The Godfather to me is a greater film.
Same.
But this is a film for everybody. Like, this is a more, like, whatever. What's the word I'm looking for? Like, a film you can kind of show anybody? Accessible?
Yeah.
This is the most accessible, great film that's ever been made. I'm so thankful I'm able to live in a world where I'm able... Like, I live in a time I'm able to be alive when Jaws is also in the world. Like, how blessed am I to see something that great?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's one of those things where we maybe as not old, but like older people, like we don't even realize how insane and like in society altering it was, because it creates the modern summer blockbuster. Because summer was when they would dump movies. Like, that's where you put the shitty movies out, was during the summer. That completely changes on its head after Jaws. Now all like the big blockbusters, because of this, are all coming out in summer. On top of that, like literally beach tourism went down because of this movie. That's how fucking pervasive it was in society and how much it frightened society. It was people stopped going to the beach because of Jaws. Tourism went down. That's how insane it is. And then, I mean, just so many great moments. I would say Robert Shaw's performance in this, if you want to put it up against anything else in a Spielberg movie, you could put it, I would have no problem. His USS Indianapolis like monologue is just among one of my all-time favorites, just like acting scenes. His death scene is unbelievable.
All-time great score. Introduction, like just in terms of just like introing a character, like that's up there for like top 10 all time. Just in the everybody speaking and him just scratching the fucking chalkboard with a piece of chalk. It's so good. It's amazing.
And the theme, I think, again, you want to put it up against any of the most iconic themes in movie history. It's right there. It's just, it's such an important movie. And I think it's aged great, especially when you consider like, it's a goofy looking shark. Like, it should be something where it's like, almost like to me, like when I watched The Exorcist, I watched it like later in life. And my mom had always told me like, The Exorcist is the scariest movie you're ever going to watch. No doubt about it. And I watched, I'm like, this is kind of goofy. Like,
that breaks my heart. And you're not the first person to say that. I've heard a lot of stories of that, and that just makes me really sad.
Like, it's just like when I watch that.
Exorcist to me is terrifying.
But then when I watch Jaws, which is similarly, it's like it's a giant shark puppet. You know, it should be goofy.
Yes,
I'm horrified.
Yeah.
I am on the edge of my seat, horrified. Don't want to go near the water. Even now to this day, like when I go in the water, I'm a little bit scared because of Jaws. And it's just, I think that just goes to show you how great of a film it is. It's just absolute brilliant filmmaking. Shout out George Lucas, broke one of the sharks, right?
Oh, I don't remember that story.
I believe when he came to visit him while he was filming it and accidentally broke one of the sharks that they used. That's very funny.
That's so great. Man, that was, I mean, all downhill for him after that, for Spielberg. It was early.
All downhill afterwards. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, what a filmography. God, iconic. Mm-hmm. I'm just, there's an iconic scene in all of these. I only have, in terms of, because this did get sent out because Jeff wasn't able to join, I only have 11 through 15, okay. but I will read them off. At 11, we had The Fablemans. Ken Jack, not on your list, but on Mine and Clemmers.
I had 10.
You had it at 11. This, weirdly, this is also, I think, one of our more aligned rankings ever.
I think so, too. Yeah, it seems that way.
Number 12, West Side Story. Ken Jack, you had a 10, but not on Klimmer's list. I had it at 10 as well. Jeff had it at 6.
Watch the original.
I know Jeff
will. The original is better, no doubt. No doubt. But it is just a very good movie.
It is better.
Watch the original.
But I like, in terms of like,
Spielberg making remakes. What are we doing?
I think if this movie had anyone else in the lead, though, this would inch towards top 5 for me. Like, there's a glaring hole at the middle with Ansel Elgort, and he's a huge problem with the movie. But outside of that, I think like color, like the choreography, the production, it's just, it works. Number 13, Munich, which it might end up, if I had finished the movie last night, we might have had to rework this because I was vibing with it. Eric Bana.
It's very good.
It's incredible. It's a
where's
great,
he been?
This few movies show the price of revenge greater than this one. This shows you how it can destroy your soul. And it's an amazing film. Munich is incredible. If people haven't seen it, check it out.
It also has that, I mean, obviously I haven't finished it yet, but so far it has that like nice, I don't want to say nice, but it has that globe-trotting quality to it, the Catch Me If You Can has. Like, it's jumping from place to place.
Absolutely.
I really love that.
And like period setting you in different locations across the globe, which I think is very impressive.
Yeah. Munich's fantastic.
Also just like Daniel Craig showing up, Kieran Hines showing up. Like, great cast.
Great cast.
Number 14, Minority Report. Kenjek, you had it at 14. I had it at 9. Kirk had it at 11. Jeff had it at 12. I love that movie.
I do not have it on my list. I don't really like that movie that much.
I like it a lot. It's very stylized. It's definitely, we're talking about movies that you would recommend anybody. Not one I'd recommend to everybody, but like, it's one I like.
No, and I love the concepts, and I love the Tom Cruise performance, and he's got a son, and his son wants to run fast, just like his daddy. I love it. It's one of my favorite Cruise performances. And then at number 15 is Lincoln. Kenjack, you had it at 8. Not on me and Clemmer's list.
No.
Kirk, 13. Jeff, 9. It's just, I haven't rewatched it since it came out. It's like, I think it's guilty of all the things that people accuse There Will Be Blood of, which is a great Daniel Day-Lewis performance at the middle of it, and great production, well-made film, but just boring as hell. I think it's
I wouldn't blame anyone for being bored with it. I would push back on, I think every performance in this movie is very good. Like, there's not a wasted performance in this. Like, everybody, like, whether it's like, you know, Jackie Earle Haley shows up and just crushes it. Like, every performance of this movie is very good. And I think if I'm evaluating from that and evaluating it from what they're going for as far as like story wise from Lincoln's perspective, and not giving you any real, I want to say action, but whatever. But like, it's to me very interesting. But I'm also into that stuff, so I understand why people wouldn't like it. But I'm also never going to be like, it's another one. I wouldn't say, you got to watch Lincoln. You got to watch Lincoln. Holy shit, you got to watch Lincoln. I would never say that.
Yeah.
I had four movies that were not on the list on my list.
You did.
Always. Have you guys seen Always with Holly Hunter and John Goodman and Richard Dreyfuss?
I don't think I've heard of it.
It's Audrey Hepburn's last movie. Richard Dreyfuss plays a what are those firefighters called that drop that are on the plane and they drop the stuff in the woods?
Like something droppers, like I don't know, like hot
I don't know what they're called, but like, I'm sorry, I'm just like they're heroes. They're firemen that fight fires in the air, forest fires. But Richard Dreyfuss dies in it, and he becomes a
smoke
ghost.
Smoke jumpers.
What are they called?
Smoke jumpers.
Smoke jumpers.
Sorry.
He becomes a ghost and is upset when Holly Hunter, his ex-girlfriend, is now dating somebody else. But he's a ghost. And it's very well done. It's a cute love story of sorts and with some really interesting performances. Also, I have Temple of Doom on my list at 13.
Really?
I think it's just a beautiful movie. And I think Short Round's fun. I had The Terminal on my list.
Oh, I like The Terminal too.
I had 14th. I mean, we're not talking like this is great movies, but there's elements to The Terminal, and also it's like I always think about it. What would it be like to live in an airport? Right? It's kind of a cool thing to think about. And 15th on my list is War of the Worlds, which is the movie I have issues with, but at the end of the day, like I can understand how it could entertain somebody.
Yeah, no, I think I'm in the same spot with War of the Worlds. Like it was close to my, to my top 15, but
it's this close. There's like a kids. Imagine. You remove the kids, but like you need them. But maybe
you
I don't
need
know
them. But
maybe
I think I think they're really bad kid performances. Like
they're really bad. They're really bad.
Yeah,
which is uncharacteristic for him because he's so good at getting great child performances. But I don't know what happened. I don't.
Chatwin.
He just like I don't know if he was just on set like scream more Dakota Fanning. Like, she's just fucking screaming her little head off the entire movie. Yeah. Ugh. Kinjak, do you remember what your 15 was?
No.
I don't either.
Check out
Are you telling me? Or okay, hold on. I can look it up.
That's the only one that's missing from your list. I have one, two missing from mine. I wonder what they were.
My 15 was... I did Color Purple for my 15.
Okay. Oh, okay.
I think it's a really well-made movie. Yeah. Definitely not one, again, close to the top 10 for Spielberg, but I think it's just it's really well done.
No one had Empire of the Sun either, I noticed. Which
I like Empire of the Sun.
I haven't seen in a while. So
Bale is really good.
Yeah.
Like, it's just... it's the story... I don't know. When you think about the other movies he's putting out in that decade, it's like, well, this is just not even on the same in the same stratosphere.
All it missed for me was like AI.
Oh, okay. Just never ends. Just goes on.
It's true. It quite literally never ends.
There's just something about that early 2000s futurism that I just really it vibes with me. It's like the last time the future could be really cool. You know what I mean? Like, the future just seemed really cool at that point in time.
Didn't realize AI would be, like, data centers to build, like, an AI image of Obama kissing, like, a fucking, like, a minion or whatever. You know, that's the Spielberg didn't see that one coming.
It's a lot more, replacing your dead children. Very less horrifying.
Yeah.
Also, Haley Joel Osment, just maybe the greatest child actor of all time.
Not going to get an argument.
Yeah, I mean, he's really good in that movie. But yeah, that's Spielberg. You want to wrap it up, Jack?
Yep, that's Spielberg. So next week we will be doing Toy Story 5, and I believe The Death of Robin Hood. We should be doing The Death of Robin Hood.
I don't think you'll have me for that one, guys. I'm not back for like 2 or 3 weeks.
The Death of Clemmerhood.
No, hopefully I survive. Hopefully I'll be alive. But I might not see you guys again until July.
Oh, fuck. You're going to miss Supergirl, aren't you?
I am. No, I saw it.
Yeah, you mean Robbie saw it together, yeah. Yeah. Robbie Fox, that is. Yeah.
Right. But so we did see it, but you know, I won't be on the show, I don't believe.
Yeah. But the next week we'll be doing Toy Story 5 and Death of Robin Hood. Very excited, and we will see you guys then.